People don't know their neighbors. It was really amazing to put those barriers down and just get to know where everyone is.
Cafe Hope with me, Rachel Burden, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It led to something that's so much bigger.
Monday mornings at 9:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 5th of September. This is Tina Ritchie. Good morning. Reform UK will end their conference in Birmingham today with a pledge to increase the amount of money most people can earn before starting to pay income tax if they form the next government. After yesterday's proceedings were overshadowed by an undercover investigation which prompted the suspension of two party officials, Reform's Treasury spokesman Robert Jenrick will try to put policy back in the spotlight. Our political editor Chris Mason reports from Birmingham.
Reform have endured a difficult few days here, buffeted by the undercover filming broadcast by Channel 4 News, which led to the suspension of two key party figures. Robert Jenrick will attempt today to shift the focus back to policy. Currently, most people can earn just over £12,500 per year before having to pay income tax. This is known as the personal allowance. Mr. Jenrick will say later, as Chancellor, he would lift this to £15,000 and estimates this would save most taxpayers around £500 a year and mean 2.9 million people would stop paying income tax altogether. It would be paid for, he will argue, by cutting some benefits, capping foreign aid spending and scrapping net zero programmes.
President Trump has indicated that his two main envoys will take a new proposal to end the war in Ukraine with them to Moscow. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Steve Witkoff are expected to arrive in the Russian capital today. President Zelensky of Ukraine has said the envoys will be in Kyiv tomorrow. The Chief Constable of Cleveland Police, Victoria Fuller, has used a BBC interview to criticise what she described as a lack of funding and resources following a fatal crash which killed seven people, including two police officers. Earlier this week, the Home Secretary said the force would be given an extra £2 million. Nick Johnson reports.
Paying tribute to PCs Matthew Blades and Tom Clough, the Chief Constable of Cleveland Police, Victoria Fuller, said they paid the ultimate price in the line of duty. Nearly 30 people have since been arrested in the Middlesbrough area as part of a wider police operation against organised crime following the crash. Chief Constable Fuller said Cleveland Police has been subject to the largest decrease in officers of any force in the country since 2010, despite policing an area with the highest levels of recorded crime in England and Wales.
The father of three young children who were killed by their mother in Massachusetts has said the prospect of reliving the tragedy through a second trial is extraordinarily painful. Patrick Clancy was speaking after his former wife's murder trial collapsed, with the judge declaring it a mistrial. Lindsay Clancy has admitted strangling their children, but her lawyers say she was suffering from postpartum psychosis. The prosecution hasn't yet decided whether to request a fresh trial. An independent review of maternity care at NHS hospitals in Sussex gets underway today. The senior midwife, Donna Ockenden, will examine more than 1,000 cases going back to 2018 and meet some of the parents whose babies died or suffered harm while under the care of University Hospitals Sussex NHS Trust. Hannah Robotham lost her two-day-old son, Austin, in 2022.
He had been in distress for many hours. I was asking for help. And if they had acted when those signs were first shown, he would be here.
And when we meet new families and we hear of those same mistakes being repeated again, I want to know why that hasn't been addressed and why changes haven't been made.
The Sussex NHS Trust says it has introduced improvements. Research suggests nearly a third of Britons believe poor numeracy skills have made them worse off over the past year. The survey by a House of Lords committee found mobile phone contracts and subscription deals were among the things people struggle to understand. That's your news. Here with the weather is Elizabeth Rezzini.
Hello, good morning again. Well, there's lots of fine and dry weather around this weekend. No heat wave, but it is going to be feeling a bit warmer than it has been. And then low pressure returns into the start of next week. So we'll see some wet and windy weather right across the UK. It's going to be quite blustery there for some, particularly in the north and the west through this weekend. But for this morning, it's a cooler start than we saw yesterday. Just to the west of the UK, we will see a little bit more in the way of clouds. So for northern and western Scotland, some morning showers, sunny spells, patchy clouds and a few more scattered showers into the afternoon. Northern Ireland set to turn a lot cloudier later on through the day. And for northern and western Wales and for northwest England, generally, there will be more cloud too into the afternoon. The fresh westerly winds are gradually easing throughout the day. For the rest of England and Wales, well, it's looking dry throughout the day. There'll be lots of sunshine away from the far west. And again, the breeze will gradually lighten. 16 to 19 Celsius in the north, 21 to 24 degrees further south and east.
Time now for a look at the papers. And the headlines won't be what Nigel Farage would have been hoping after his speech to the Reform UK conference. The Times said it was overshadowed by an expose about political donations broadcast by Channel 4. Well, The Guardian talks about pressure on the leader, saying the party became engulfed by scandal. Noting that Mr Farage has admitted Reform needs to professionalise, the Daily Express quotes him as saying, "Yes, we absolutely must do better." For the Daily Mirror, Reform is in chaos. The headline in The Sun is more upbeat for Reform, saying Mr Farage hit back with the message, "They're scared of us." He described the undercover filming as a prolonged exercise in entrapment. The Guardian says the Chancellor, John Healey, is acutely conscious of factors beyond his control that are severely limiting his room for manoeuvre in October's budget. In an interview with the FT Weekend, Mr Healey acknowledges that households are feeling the cost of living pressures, just as firms are feeling the cost of business pressures. The paper says he's politically exposed after resigning as Defence Secretary because his predecessor as Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, would not commit to allocating 3% of GDP to defence by 2030. An ally of Ms Reeves texted the FT with the message, "Lol," the paper notes. Writing in the Daily Mail, the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson says Andy Burnham must get a grip and send reinforcements to the Falklands after Argentina's latest claim to the British-owned islands off its coast. The Daily Telegraph says it would take about 4 weeks to sail UK aircraft carriers to the 8,000 miles to the South Pacific. The Sun says that for now, the only reason Argentina has confined itself to sabre-rattling is that its own army is so small. That concludes our look at the papers. As the UK experiences its worst ever outbreak of the livestock disease blue tongue, we find out how government vets and scientists are coping as they deal with thousands of cases. That's on Farming Today this week in half an hour. But now on Radio 4, cricket commentator Alison Mitchell goes to witness an extraordinary match on the Solent. This is Open Country.
Well, it hasn't quite hit 6 a.m. The sun is starting to poke out from behind the trees that line the banks of the River Humble, which is just flowing gracefully out towards the Solent. I can hear the plink, plink of the halyards, the ropes that pull the sails up, just knocking against the masts of all these sailing boats in front of me. My normal place of work is Lords, the Oval, Trent Bridge, esteemed cricket grounds around the world. Well, today, in a minute, I'm going to be climbing into a rib and going to watch a very different sort of cricket match. I'm here now with someone who's going to play in the match, Matthew Richardson, Commodore of the Royal Southern Yacht Club. Well, Matthew, it's beautiful to be here, and what a stunning morning we have as well. Tell me about this cricket match.
So, it's named after a sandbank between the mainland and the Isle of Wight, a sandbank that only emerges from the sea about twice a year. And it happens on a super low tide, which is why it happens so early in the morning or late in the evening. And we're about to go out and see if the sand emerges, because sometimes we don't know quite how much pitch we're going to get until we get there.
So this is going to be extraordinary. So the pitch will emerge. And this is called Bramble Bank, isn't it? The sandbank. So that's the name of the match. Explain the tides then, because you... Good morning. Good morning. You and I are both geographers, we found out. So explain the spring tide and why that is important to this match.
Tide is determined by the moon, and a big tide happens at a new moon and a full moon. And when we have a particular pull of the moon and the sun, for example, following an eclipse, we get an extreme tide just a couple of times a year. And coincidentally, we have one this morning.
Are there particular rules of this match?
Standard cricket rules, 11 each side, an umpire, a toss to begin, see who's going to bat first, hopefully an innings, possibly two innings. We'll have to see how much bank we get.
And so what sort of people are going to turn out to play in this match?
Well, we have a mixture of professional cricketers and amateurs and well-known sailors, so a whole eclectic bunch of us.
Give us a few name checks.
We have Sir Robin Knox-Johnson. He is a member here of the Royal Southern.
Traditionally, he's the first man to sail solo, non-stop around the world.
I believe so, yes. And Norman Cowan is going to bowl for us today. So Norman was previously an England bowler.
I feel like Norman is a very good ring-in. He managed to get, he bowled pretty quick in his day.
Should the Island Sailing Club be worried?
I think the Island Sailing Club should be worried. And there's already a gathering here on the edge of the water. People in their waterproof gear. Hopefully that's not an omen. Nobody falls in, do they?
Well, on a big tide, it goes out and it comes in very quickly. So if people aren't able to leave the bank at the right time, when the tide is rising again, it can be quite a sort of almost an emergency evacuation. We have lifeboats standing by.
Excellent. That gives me a great amount of comfort. Well, we're going to hop into this little inflatable rib that's down here. We'll see you on the sandbank, I guess.
Fantastic.
She's just this one here on the right-hand side.
The Zodiac?
The Zodiac,
the Zodiac.
Yes.
The Zodiac will zoom us out to the sandbank. We've set off. Our engine's rumbling behind us. We've just passed the yellow and black boat of the harbour master. Get the impression that everybody is up early around the yacht club at the moment. We've been followed out by one, two, three other ribs behind us. So I really get the sense that we're going to be forming part of a flotilla, if you like, heading out to the middle of the Solent. So James, just situate us. Where exactly are we at the moment?
So we're heading down the River Hamble. We're about to pull into Wasatch, pick up some additional passengers, and then we'll be heading out the Hamble on Southampton Water, and from there out onto the Solent.
That boat's got it going well. They've got the whole family on board, including a very, very small baby being rocked. Could be the youngest participant, maybe, of this cricket match. So Sarah and Jules have just joined us on the rib. We've done a pick-up en route. Are you two regulars to this cricket match?
No, never been before.
First-timers?
Yes.
First-timers?
Yeah.
Not normally this busy on a Saturday morning.
It's quite a contrast, isn't it, with the oil refinery on our right side. Starboard side? Yes. And over on the port side, much greener.
Much greener. You've got the beach, and then you've got Maritime College, Wasatch Maritime College, that's now part of Solent University. And you still see the teams coming down and doing a lot of the lifeboat launches and practices almost daily.
Okay, everybody's happy. I'm going to speed up slightly.
We're speeding up. That's the message from James. Let's skip. Well, there's the RNLI lifeboat speeding out towards Brambleback. Hopefully not on a call. I think they're just heading out there in readiness. And we are just cutting right across their wake now, which is making our boat just bump a little bit more. There's a couple of kayakers out there. Do you think they're heading to the cricket match as well? And I think I can already see a number of boats starting to gather in the foreground ahead of the Isle of Wight. So that must be the edge of Bramble Bank that we're heading to.
Bramble Bank is straight ahead on the red mark.
Hopefully we're not going to have a collision with the Isle of Wight ferry, which is cutting right across in front of us. Pretty much at right angles right now.
There's been a lot of boats going out.
It's like a boat park in the middle of the Solent. I can't even count up all these boats and the number of people.
Oh, they're in their whites.
They're in their whites.
They're in their whites, the cricketers.
As they should be. As they should be.
They're warming up as we speak.
Well, we can distinguish the cricketers from the crowd at least. Right, time to get out. off the boat and into the water. The waves are sloshing right up against the bank at the moment, so this could be a little on the precarious side.
We are literally in the middle of the Solent.
First impressions is that the pitch is a little on the damp side. So we're now approaching the sandbank. The underlying sand here that we're walking across is really heavily undulated. So I'm going to have to go very carefully here because somebody apparently just went waist deep. I have to say, when I think of beach cricket, I generally think of a large, flat, expansive sand. This is anything but. It's like rock pools. Big pools of water with then mounds of sand, sort of like huge craters really, that are all filled with water. But up ahead of us, I see a group of cricketers in whites, surrounded by, oh, there's so many people here, and there's families, there's young children. It feels like the whole community has turned out to watch this. Oh, there's a boundary. There's actually a boundary flag here. So someone has set a boundary. This is impressive. So a game of cricket is going on. I have to say the pitch, well, that ball didn't pitch, and I think that's just as well, because who knows whether it would land in a pool of seawater, a ridge of sand. So I think full tosses are the order of the day. A very tall bowler just bowling over. Oh, that one did pitch. Oh, it's bowled him. This gentleman who's just been dismissed is wearing cricket whites. In fact, most of the guys have got their trousers pulled up above their knees. Some playing barefoot, some have got footwear of various type. Pair of trainers here, pair of boots here, almost like suede Wellingtons. That's quite ambitious. Oh, that's a big hit. Oh, dropped. One-handed drop. That was swung away over to mid-wicket. And I tell you what, if he hadn't got a hand to it, that was going straight into the crowd. Let's go find a member of the team. What's the state of play? We've just seen a catch, so well, one wicket's gone down. Oh, that's a very good defensive.
We were three for none when I came into bat.
Oh, right.
I think we're probably about 20 now for four, I think.
And what's your name?
My name's Gary. So I'm from Arrowton on the Isle of Wight and representing the Isle of Wight Sailing Club.
It was a sailing club, now a cricket club.
Yes.
Have you played in this match before?
No, I'm on debut.
Congratulations.
No, it's great, isn't it? It's madness. It's absolutely madness, but absolutely brilliant.
First time I've interviewed a cricketer standing calf deep in
a puddle.
Seawater. It's remarkable.
It really
like
is.
I see you've got men and women as part of your team.
Yeah.
We're a real mixture.
Did you not catch my six?
I didn't see
straight
your
drive,
six.
Straight drive for six. Straight drive.
Over the heads of the spectators.
Lost ball.
Lost ball.
Into the sea.
Oh, well, I was about to say, what happens when the ball gets hit into the ocean?
Another one. Hopefully the drones picked it up.
Oh, I've just caught, turned around over my shoulder. It's an army of yellow and black clad men and women approaching with helmets on them. They almost look like they could be out of Star Wars, but it's the RNLI. Come to look after us and make sure everyone is safe. So I'm just falling over as I'm talking. I can't stand still. I keep sinking into the sand. Oh, I've just seen the ball plop into a puddle. So I think I'm playing with a pink cricket ball. It does actually look from here like it is a proper leather cricket ball. Oh. So they have got proper stumps wedged into the sand by the looks of it. Oh, they're a little crooked now. Somebody's just got bowled. The Isle of Wight have just lost another wicket. Oh, can I get an interview with the batsman who's just been dismissed? I'm Alison Mitchell. Nice to meet you.
Hi.
You just got bowled?
I hit my own wicket.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, disappointing. Oh, there's another one down. Oh, you're falling like nine pins at the moment. Is this a proper cricket ball you're playing with?
It is, yeah.
Does so it we float? Played,
no. Oh. Gary tonked one for six, a couple of overs ago, and it sank. It took a little while for them to retrieve it.
What's your assessment of the surface?
It's a little bit bobbly.
Looks it from here.
Yeah. Either that or the guy that just was bowling's a wizard on the spin because it turns some on the surface.
But have you played in this match before?
I played last year, and honestly, the conditions couldn't be any further different. This is gorgeous. So we're playing on a strip no bigger than this.
Right.
And the rest, we were kind of 2 feet deep in water.
Ooh.
It was raining, it was cold, it was miserable.
So we've been quite lucky then this year.
Superbly lucky, yes.
Oh yeah, there's a scoreboard.
Hey, last year we literally probably three overs each,
yeah.
And then we all had to get out of here.
So what happens when the tide starts to come in? Is there some kind of klaxon or something that says, you know, everybody to their boats?
No, again, quintessentially English, nobody's really organised. So yeah, the water starts coming in and
word gets around.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, they're running. So I'm looking out to the middle of the pitch. Beyond, I can see the Isle of Wight, beyond a huge stretch of water, low rise of green trees, only obscured by the masts of more boats that are approaching us here on Bramble Bank. And then as I spin round 360, the Isle of Wight then gives way to the ocean again, and then you can start to see the mainland once more. And we are just in an island, really. It's remarkable. A secret island that has appeared out of nowhere. And in, I don't know, maybe another 45 minutes, it's going to disappear again just as quickly. It feels like we're in some sort of secret, unworldly existence at the moment. It does feel like this landscape is somewhat like the moon. Huge craters filled with seawater and then lumpy bits of sand. Oh. That ball's just been clipped into one of the craters. It does float, I think, this cricket ball. Oh, here's Norman Cowan's bowling. Gentleman's just remarked, Norman must think, what the hell is going on here? A little bit different to the cricket grounds he's played at, the MCG in Melbourne, Lords. Oh, little outside edge drops into the turf. Pick up throw at the stumps, misses. The fielder's fallen on his backside into the water. He gets up. He's got brown sand all over his whites. That'll need to go in the wash. Oh, that's a lovely straight drive back up to Cowan's. But this is beach cricket in every sense. I mean, yes, there are stumps in the ground, and nominally there are flags marked for a boundary that is about, I don't know, 5 metres away. Oh, that was a run-out chance. Missed again, I think. And the spectators are just lining the boundary, really, nominal boundary. But I think the spectators almost make the boundary, to be honest. I think if you clear the heads of everybody here, it must be a six. So a six is when the ball clears the rope, clears the boundary without bouncing first. Oh, that was a terrible delivery, head height. I think fours might be quite hard to come by here, because if you stroke the ball along the ground to the boundary, it's liable to just plug in a huge puddle. Oh, that's a good innings. Right, so let's have a look at the scoreboard. There is actually a scoreboard over here. So that was the Isle of Wight innings. We're just waiting for them to update the scoreboard. Let's go a bit closer. You're in charge of keeping the score today?
Well, I don't. Yeah, that seems to be my minions who are doing.
What's your name?
Shira.
Lovely to meet you, Shira. So it's 100 to win, is it? They've scored 99.
Yes.
Nominally.
Yes.
There's a bit of loose scoring going on here.
Yeah.
I think this scoring is very dubious.
Well, it's our turn to win, so that's the...
Is that how it works?
Yes. Next year it'll be the other way around for the island.
So. Right. How long have you been coming out to this match at
Bramble
Bank?
About 10 years. So, I mean, it's like last year was horrendous because it was blowing so hard. But this year, you know, we're lucky to... It's cleared quite well.
I was going to say, it's not the sort of cricket conditions that I normally associate with cricket.
When we had Stuart Broad coming out, I think he had an England game the next day, and I was terrified he was going to break his ankle.
Stuart Broad, England fast bowler, ever the competitor. Did he bowl fast on this?
Absolutely.
Of course.
Is it what you expected?
I didn't know what to expect. I think when I imagined beach cricket, I was imagining certainly a flatter surface. But this is the seabed. Hello, Norman.
Hello.
Alan. How are you? Good to see you. I tell you what, though, what about this cricket match?
I know.
How have you got involved into it?
A friend of mine from my gym who was a member of the yacht club asked me if I'd mind playing, so that's how I got into it.
I mean, I did not expect to turn up to a sandbank in the middle of the Solent and find former England fast bowler Norman Cowans rolling his arm over. You weren't steaming in off a full run, though, Norman. I saw you.
No, I think the equators are here and might have prevented that from happening.
I was going to say, you cannot have played on too many surfaces like this in your time.
No, not like this. I mean, this is like playing on a surface, like on the moon or something.
That's
lots
what
of
I felt.
Different craters and trying to find a level surface. But, I mean, it's just British eccentricity, isn't it? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Oh, that's a wallop.
Yeah.
Have you felt a fair amount of expectation on your shoulders? You know, you needing to carry the team?
I've got a couple of wickets. I mean, I got a full banger first ball, which I missed, which unfortunately hit the stump. So a bit gutted about that, but, you know, that's a game of cricket, really. But at least I got a couple of wickets, which is good.
That's a contribution.
But, you know, it's not like I can come up a long run or anything like that.
Two paces out of the water.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that this many people would be here. I'm very, very chuffed, really, at the amount of people who've turned up. But,
Oh, ouch. He's been struck on the chest, I think. Yeah, that's a vicious bouncer. Ooh. No one's wearing any pads. That's the other thing I noticed. This is true beach cricket.
No pads. And it's a proper leather ball as well.
Yeah.
So, actually, that one.
Oh, he's got a grubber. That one's just scooted along the ground into the base of the stump, so he's out.
Yeah.
Oh, a brilliant catch behind. Taken to his right, the wicketkeeper. Oh, he's got a handshake from the batter as he departs.
That's
true sportsmanship, that.
Tomo, you're lucky there, man. You were lucky. That was a
bit unlucky.
Catch.
I was just trying to slide that down the outside.
Lucky there, man.
Oh, got 86 already. Actually, getting close to the victory mark here. Does that mean the tide might be coming in? It's a theme here with the ball not bouncing very much and scooting through to hit the stumps. Right, sailing legend Sir Robin Knox-Johnston has just got into bat. He's 87 years old now. He is doing well to be out here in Bramble Bank. He's a left-hander, I'm noticing. He's got his full cricket whites on. He's got his right leg trouser a little rolled up halfway up his calf. I don't think he's managed to lay bat on one yet, but to be fair, the conditions are quite tricky and the bounce of the ball is anything but consistent. Oh, we just got a moon ball. That was a big looping delivery, a swing and a miss from Sir Robin. Here's another one, a slower one. Oh, blimey, I think there's a fielder at short mid-wicket wearing a pair of white Crocs. He was in danger of being struck if he'd made contact with that one. So Robin, how many years have you been involved in the Bramble Bank cricket match?
30, maybe 30. It's on and off, you know. Sometimes I'm away and so I can't play, but if I'm around, they're very kind and invite me to play.
Yeah.
Because as you realise, if you watch, I'm not very good at cricket, but I love the game.
Well, that's what cricket is so much about, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
I feel like this is a beautiful coming together of the sailing community and cricket lovers all
that's
together.
Right.
Was the match very competitive?
Very competitive, as you realise. I mean, we have to fight very hard to win. And, of course, this year we were trying to revenge a disastrous loss last year.
What does the sailing community sort of mean to you? I mean, obviously, it's been your life forever, but, you know, events like this, it really seems to bring people together.
Well, you know, I think if you take sailing, it's a competitive sport. We like competitive sport. This Brambles match is a jokey match, it's eccentric, it's very British in that respect, and it's fun, but we enjoy getting together and doing it. So if we can't get out in our boats, then we'll find some other sport to watch.
Yeah.
But I do love the game.
What about this particular stretch of water, Sir Robin? How familiar is this to you personally?
Well, I used to live in Hamble, now I live in Portsmouth, so it's Solent-based. And I used to race a lot here in Admiral's Cup and things like that, which is, we were in the British team. And the Brambles, it's an interesting bank. If you're racing, you do have to avoid it.
Yeah.
I went aground on it once in a race, a charity race, and my crew said, we get the sails down. No, leave them up. Why? I said, I'm not going to be the only one laughed at. And six other boats followed me on, thinking I was still sailing. And they all said, you bastard, you were a grand. I said, yeah, you're not laughing at me.
Did you ever imagine then that you might be back on Brambles wearing cricket whites one day?
Oh, well, I think in those days I was occasionally playing anyway. So.
Amazing.
It's great fun. It's one of those lovely things that I think it'll go on forever. But just because we all get a zip out of it.
And I think that's the end of the game. Norman Cowens, what's the result? What's happened?
It's RSNY
102.
ISC 99.
So the Island Sailing Club has lost out on this occasion. I'll get you going to celebrate with your team. But lots of handshakes going on. There's a huddle now in the middle of Bramble Bank. The tide is still quite a long way out at the moment. Whether it is encroaching, though, it could well be, and that might have hastened the end of this cricket match. But they're all getting together for a team photograph with the sun much higher in the sky now. It's just a great array. What a motley crew. The cricket whites, some with their trousers rolled up, some with bare feet, some with trainers, some with Crocs. Everyone just having had a brilliant, fun morning. And that's what I guess cricket and sailing is all about.
So we should walk back to the boat because where we are, we'll probably get very wet getting back on it in a second,
right,
where the water's coming in.
Okay, right, we've got the hurry on. The huddle is breaking away and it's like a rush back to your boat, I tell you. I can see why we're being hurried back to our boat, because now we are getting closer to it. The sea really has come in quite significantly from when we parked up. So we're not to the water yet. There's me going down to knee deep in the water. As fast as everyone arrived, everyone is about to leave. The sea will move back in over the pitch. Bramble Bank, the sand, the stumps, the little scoreboard, the little flags in the ground. None of it will be visible. It'll just be ocean. And it will be like none of this ever happened.
Oh, what a great adventure. Open Country was produced in Bristol by Eliza Lomas from BBC Audio. Across the weekend and next week, Radio 4 is marking the 25th anniversary of 9/11 with a series of special programmes. One of them is tomorrow's Sunday Worship, which comes from churches either side of Ground Zero in New York. That's at 8:10 tomorrow morning. Farming Today this week is next.
Ever feel like you just missed out on something amazing? With BBC Sounds, you can ask most smart speakers to go back to the start of the show. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart. So you never miss a thing again.
Coming up next, Friday Night Comedy.
Get more from your smart speaker with BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, Farming Today this week with Anna Hill.
Good morning. This week, plans for a string of data centres between Glasgow and Edinburgh prompt a growing tide of objections.
We don't have a lot of good agricultural land in Scotland, and some of the land in this area is some of the best in Scotland, so to just put it under concrete seems like a shame, really.
Low morale and a mountainous workload, the government vets and scientists processing thousands of tests for blue tongue disease.
They've reported that they're feeling absolutely exhausted and psychologically bruised and battered at the moment. It's all hands to the pump, really, with this outbreak.
And why conservationists want to hear more of this unusual noise. It's not a reversing van, it's a corncrake. We'll have more a little later. First, though, the farm vet with a passion for nature and dung beetles in particular. After years of working in the industry, Claire Whittle says she realised that the worming products she was prescribing for sheep and cows were damaging the wildlife she cared about. She's now taken on a hill farm near Wrexham and is building up a herd of beef cattle. She also works as a regenerative vet consultant, teaching people how to farm livestock with fewer medicines. Rebecca Rooney's been to meet her.
Rubber gloves are on. So if you are going to go and fertile around in a poo pile, I'd suggest that you wear gloves. Pull that apart. You can see this guy. Can you see those tiny little antennae on their head? They look like little jazz hands. And they basically open up those jazz hands as they fly, and then they zigzag their way into a poo pile. So that's how they smell.
And why are you so pleased to see that dung beetle?
I'm really glad to see them because I know they're playing a role in keeping my cows healthy, really. And also because they're important in themselves. And they're also really, really important prey species. So a lot of our wading birds, like lapwing and godwit and redshank, they've all been found to have dung beetle wing casings in their feces. It's this whole part of this farm ecosystem, but that poo in itself is its own ecosystem. And talking about the things that are in there, I describe it as a night out in Liverpool. So, Phil, you've got your creepy guys hanging out on the street corners. They're going to be things like your parasitic flies and your parasitic worms and the kind of things that cause problems in your livestock. They might be handing out a few drugs, you know, a little bit of worming product. And then you've got your predatory bugs and your predatory beetles in there, and they're basically having a massive scrap. So they're going through the streets of Liverpool, they're kicking off on everything else, they want a fight, they know how valuable that poo is, and they want to be in there because they want to eat something in there. And then you've got your dung beetles, and they're just going from bar to bar getting drunk on liquid dung, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're drinking that poo, they're drying that poo out, and they're making it unsuitable for our parasites to complete their life cycles. And then on top of that, you've got all the different fly species, and they're basically breeding all over it. So if you've ever been for a night out in Liverpool, you've got all of those things going on.
You can hear much more about poo from Claire Whittle in On Your Farm here on BBC Radio 4 tomorrow morning at 6:30. Now, all this week we've been travelling the waterways of the UK to hear about the health of our rivers and meeting the people working to improve them. Finding out exactly what species are in a river is key to assessing its health, but it can be challenging. Well, now, environmental DNA sampling, or eDNA, is being used. It detects the presence of rare or invasive species by analysing genetic material in water. It's a technique that's been embraced in Cumbria by conservation charity the Eden Rivers Trust, who have a catchment area of 2,500 square kilometres to look after. Helen Milliken joined a team of staff and volunteers near Penrith, led by conservation manager Stephen Henderson.
Stephen, if I didn't know any better, I think this was a COVID testing kit that you've just unpacked.
Yeah, it looks very much similar to that, but this is an eDNA kit. You collect your river water first in a big bag, take scoops, you give it a good shake to mix up any DNA of any animals that you might have in there, and taking care not to spill any, you grab your syringe, and this is where you start filtering the water through.
Do you want me to hold the water bag for
you,
Stephen?
Oh, that'd be lovely, thank you. We pop a preservative in, that just keeps the DNA in good condition, and then we'll send it down to the company that we use, and they'll start screening it for an assay, which is basically a sequence of DNA that they've made, looking for the specific species we're looking for. We use it a lot in our catchment for water vole, which we protect. Invasive species like American mink and crayfish plague, but we can also use them for other protected species like freshwater pearl mussels, eels. We could also use them for white claw crayfish too.
And we're in a fairly big river, the River Lowther, today, but you have been doing this in really small becks, quite high up on the East Fell side as well. Just how much of a game changer is this eDNA technique in that environment?
Oh, massively. Like, some of these areas are extremely remote and areas where we haven't really worked. It's not perfect. It does have its limitations. It's only going to tell you if a species is there or not at the time you take the sample. It doesn't give you the richness of data that other types of surveys do. But what it can do is enable you to get data from geographical areas that are quite hard to reach.
Joe Clements is conservation manager for the Lowther Estate.
It's great to have any kind of information about what's going on in the river. It's just a hidden world, I suppose, to most of us, isn't it? Historically, we've spent a lot of time trying to keep the river off the land, building embankments, dredging rivers. But really now what we want to do here is allow the river to behave more naturally, interact with its floodplain. We want to see little bits of erosion locally and then deposition and all that different types of sediment in the river, which are really important to all the different species, particularly things like salmon and trout that are living in there. And also just reducing the intensity of your farming operations. We're still farming here and grazing the land, but we don't have super high numbers of livestock, and we're not letting them down to graze along the riverbanks all the time. And that gives all this bankside vegetation a chance to grow and flower. That's the habitat for your water voles as well, amongst all that bankside vegetation.
How do you see this progressing in the future then, Stephen?
So I think it is going to be a really essential tool, particularly for teams like ours that are quite small. Some of the species that we look for, like white claw crayfish, doing surveys for them can take days, whereas this is something that we can do for populations that we might not know are there within 20 minutes.
It's like playing on the beach when you're a kid, isn't it? Going rock pooling. You can't draw too much attention to the life in the river and how much it needs protecting.
Joe Clements there from the Lowther Estate. The many pressures on land use and water use are coming into sharp focus in Scotland, where opposition is growing to a series of large AI data centres planned across the central belt between Glasgow and Edinburgh. The ruling Scottish National Party's National Council is calling for a moratorium on building them. Most of the centres are to be built on open countryside, and farmers are among the people who've raised concerns. But the boss of one data centre company has claimed the centres could bring a remarkable agricultural boost. Richard Baines reports.
So we're just filling up the drying trays to get the barley dried.
Daniel Barry farms 260 acres here at Rathow Mains, near Edinburgh. A huge AI data centre is planned on farmland at nearby Hermiston.
It's a lovely big agricultural field. They've got potatoes in it this year. A lovely crop. It'd be sad to think of it getting put under concrete and used for really was an industrial purpose. We don't have a lot of good agricultural land in Scotland, and some of the land in this area is some of the best in Scotland. So to just put it under concrete seems like a shame, really.
Hermiston developers Apertura say the site was identified after detailed assessment of environmental, transport, energy and other considerations. But Daniels is one of many voices opposed to the 24 hyperscale AI data centres planned for Scotland, most of them in open country. NFU Scotland has warned that while AI development is important, it should not use farmland unnecessarily. And among the major concerns is their energy use. Here at Octotool in Fife, there's a consultation at the village hall about plans to build one of the world's largest data centres nearby. Villagers are protesting outside. But what if such centres could in fact be a huge boost to agriculture?
It's on industrial land, zoned for employment.
Inside the Octotool hall, Mark Wilson, the boss of ILI, sets out reasons for his company building the proposed centre here.
You pretty much can't see it from the village. There's a lot of renewables in the area that we can tap into.
And Wilson believes the energy use can provide a major benefit to farmers.
There's a load of heat that comes from data centres. We can give the heat away for free to landowners, where they can then grow fruit, in particular tomatoes in polytunnels. We're in advanced talks with a number of landowners. We can actually make Scotland one of the top locations globally for tomato growing, to create a resurgence of a food industry. That's who ILI are. That's what we're all about. It's not all about money.
The charity Action to Protect Rural Scotland is leading opposition here to such data centres. Its chief executive is Kat Jones.
So this data centre is projected to use half the energy of all of Scotland's households in 2024. That is a vast amount of energy, and to say that they're going to grow some tomatoes and that is the benefit of it is ludicrous.
Scotland's only large-scale commercial tomato grower was also sceptical.
Heat is part of growing tomatoes, but it's a small part.
Jim Shanks started growing tomatoes in a glasshouse, not polytunnels, at Standhill Farm near Hoyk in the Scottish Borders 10 years ago.
Around the country, there is enough waste heat going about in localised small scales to grow as many tomatoes as you could possibly wish for. The reason we're not coming down with tomatoes is because it's a small part of the jigsaw.
And he said labour shortages and the competition would scupper Wilson's proposal.
The labour issue is getting more and more difficult, and that stands out there by a country mile as being the biggest issue. We can't compete with the likes of a Moroccan tomato producer who doesn't have the expensive glasshouse structure that we have, that doesn't have the labour costs. We have to make sure that we are into the high-end lines to be sustainable. But it's just not as simple as we have heat, so we grow tomatoes.
Tomato grower Jim Shanks there. If there is a serious national threat to food supplies in the future, are we well prepared? Not really, according to the National Audit Office, who've published a report on resilience in England's food supply chain. The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, is the lead government department responsible for food security. And although shop shelves haven't gone empty during recent testing times, like COVID and the war in Ukraine and its threat to global wheat supplies, that doesn't mean we'll be so lucky in the future. The report comes as the Environment Secretary, Angela Eagle, warned people to store food for weather emergencies. She told the Guardian newspaper that we're about to experience probably the largest El Niño ever seen, and that rising sea temperatures in the Pacific this autumn would cause flooding in Asia and lead to more extreme weather in this country too. I'll quote her here. She said, "I think that we need to take it seriously. If you've got a store of a bit of food that can keep you going for a while before the emergency services can get to you, you're going to be a lot better off than if you haven't. So some of it is that kind of preparation for just being a bit more resilient." Well, Kaz Graham talked to Rich Sullivan-Jones, who wrote the report for the National Audit Office.
It's something that DEFRA is itself taking more seriously and has been doing for a short while. I mean, it still considers the risks of a kind of a catastrophic disruption to food supply or a severe disruption to food supply low, but it does see these risks increasing in complexity and potential severity and in likelihood. So it has itself stepped up some of its planning for, say, a national power outage or the way it's taking part in the Cabinet Office's Home Defence Programme. It's the, you know, translating that into what to do in practice is where we found some limitations. And the big limitation we highlight really is that it hasn't done enough in recent years to fully engage with businesses, with local communities and households to sort of build that resilience. You know, engagement was good during the pandemic, but has reduced since, where there's been less of an emergency to have to respond to. Some countries have given more information to the public in general and to industry, actually to businesses, on how to be prepared for an emergency. And for example, with food, how many days worth of food and what type of food should be stored so you're able to continue to feed yourself in a healthy way for 3 days, for example. And where DEFRA has been much less active, I think, is really involving, you know, the food supply chain itself in developing the plans, the response plans, and indeed testing them for through scenario exercises. So there's a real weakness in the fact that, you know, DEFRA doesn't have the confidence that its response plans would actually work in practice.
One of the things that I picked up on the report is a paragraph that says DEFRA assessed the cost of developing a full emergency plan for food was disproportionate to the level of risk and likelihood, although this decision was not informed by an explicit assessment of risk appetite. DEFRA is instead developing a more basic plan. I mean, people who look back to planning in the Department of Health around COVID-19 may just look at that and say, this is exactly the kind of thing that can come back and bite a government department.
Well, this is exactly our concern. And I think in the past, there may well have been a quite reasonable assessment to say the likelihood of this really severe disruption is low. The cost of developing a fully fledged detailed plan would be very, very high. But this is something that we've looked at across a range of our work on risk and resilience, is this question of risk appetite. How much risk are you as a government department willing to seek or accept? And do you understand that? And how do you then use that to inform how you prioritise what you work on? So it is something that we have recommended that DEFRA kind of take another look at.
How serious is this? I mean, what are the consequences if DEFRA doesn't get its act together over this?
It's quite hard to say, actually, because the recent examples that we have seen, even the COVID pandemic, which was quite significant, you know, particularly in terms of household and consumer demand for food increasing very suddenly and all the panic buying and so on, is that actually, you know, some relatively medium-sized government interventions, such as providing food packages to vulnerable households who are shielding, and some relaxation of things like lorry driver hours and competition rules and so on, actually allowed food availability to be maintained for the sector to continue to be able to function and run smoothly. So nothing has seriously tested our food supply. So it's difficult to say, actually, you know, the extent to which the sector would be unable to cope. But you don't want to wait and find out, is our view here.
Rich Sullivan-Jones from the National Audit Office. Well, the government's been criticised for lack of preparation on food security, but ministers have also been condemned for the way they're handling the livestock disease blue tongue. More than 800 cases have now been confirmed across England, Wales and southwest Scotland, and some 2,500 potential cases are also under investigation. And a case here means each individual farm, not every animal. It's the worst outbreak the UK has seen. The disease is spread by midges. It can cause birth defects and kill sheep, cattle, deer, goats and camelids such as llamas. It doesn't infect people. In the House of Commons on Thursday, MPs wanted to know what the government was doing to tackle the rising number of cases. The Shadow Minister for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, Robbie Moore, accused ministers of being asleep at the wheel.
Farmers and vets are being forced to wait up to 3 weeks for blood test results, leaving the livestock sector without a real-time picture of the outbreak. So why was testing capacity not significantly increased over the summer period? And when will ministers clear this backlog? In hotspot areas, will proportionate risk-based approach be adopted? Those delays are more concerning given that DEFRA's expenditure on blue tongue testing was significantly reduced under this Labour government by 74% in this financial year. Why did the government allow this spending to fall so dramatically just as the outbreak was accelerating?
Well, the farming minister, Stephen Morgan, said DEFRA was working closely with livestock keepers and the industry to reduce the impact of the disease.
I must stress that the government has acted quickly to secure increased vaccine supply. Vaccination does remain the only effective long-term option for disease control, and we will continue to engage all keepers of susceptible animals to discuss vaccine options with them. With regards to testing capacity at Purbright and Alpha, we have stepped up capacity for testing and worked closely with industry on these, and we will continue to work with our keepers to ensure that the sector is supported, and I continue to engage with the National Sheep Association, the NFU and others on the issues at hand.
Minister Stephen Morgan. Well, all testing for blue tongue was initially carried out in labs at the Purbright Institute. But as the number of cases increased rapidly, the government's now also using its own labs at Weybridge to try and tackle the backlog. But frontline staff are struggling to keep up. Kaz Graham spoke to Prospect, the union which represents those DEFRA vets and scientists. Stephen Littlewood told her morale is low.
Well, it's incredibly stressful for them, as you can imagine. They'll be out there working with farmers, testing animals, carrying out the tests. They've reported that they're feeling absolutely exhausted and psychologically bruised and battered at the moment. It's all hands to the pump, really, with this outbreak. They're often having conversations with farmers who are understandably themselves very stressed and upset and frustrated. Our members are basically the face of the department or the face of the government when interacting with them, so they have to deal with that. So it's really a stressful situation for them at the moment.
It must be very distressing sometimes for them dealing with farmers who are really upset about what's going on their farms, but also really upset about the length of time it's taking for testing to take place and for test results to come back as well.
That's right, yeah. So they're effectively the face of things that they are not necessarily responsible for, but they have to carry that burden. But I think the lesson of all of this is there needs to be greater investment in preparing for outbreaks like this and for planning around national resilience. Because the issue we've got at the moment, whether it's with our members being stretched to the bone, whether it's with the issues around testing, is there's not enough planning. The focus has really been on dealing with outbreaks when they happen rather than trying to anticipate the next one and to deal with that. Because there isn't that joined up thinking, they just feel that they're being dragged from one crisis to another. The pay and reward package is not sufficient to attract people. I mean, APHA and DEFRA themselves have said this to the Public Accounts Committee, that we need to do better at attracting and recruiting and retaining people. Otherwise, we're just going to constantly have these cycles of short-termism, not enough staff, not enough testing capacity, and the frustrations of farmers, consumers and our members.
Is that one of the reasons that testing is taking so long? There just aren't enough people doing it.
That's one of the issues. I mean, they're trying to bring in some private sector capacity, just as they're trying to bring in some contingent labour, locums, agency staff to try and deal with issues all through the chain. But yeah, the essential underlying reason is the lack of investment. There just isn't enough capacity in the system. There is overtime. There are people working unpaid overtime, working their fingers to the bone, but they can only deal with the resources that they have.
Stephen Littlewood from Prospect. In a statement, the government said, "This is an incredibly difficult time for animal keepers and vets who are on the front line of this disease, and we are monitoring the situation closely. We've scaled up our response with the Animal and Plant Health Agency's laboratory in Weybridge, now undertaking blue tongue sample testing to meet the increased demand, while also working with vaccine manufacturers to increase vaccine supplies so that farmers who've not already done so can vaccinate their livestock." Now, to the modern ear, that might sound remarkably similar to a supermarket delivery van in reverse, but it is, in fact, the call of the corncrake, once common, now rare. Development in the countryside and changes to farming drove this small, brown and loud bird almost to extinction. The RSPB says they've identified only around 1,100 calling males in the UK, but that number may be about to grow. BBC Look North's environment correspondent Paul Murphy reports from the Lower Derwent Valley Nature Reserve in Yorkshire.
They were once the sound of summer, but as farming became more intensive, these shy birds disappeared. Only the males make this call, and only around 1,000 have been heard in recent years, mainly in Scotland. But a batch of young corncrakes, reared in captivity, has been transported to a meadow in Yorkshire.
Bringing them back to here is really exciting.
Craig Ralston is a conservationist with Natural England.
It's kind of the missing soundscape, if you like, that jigsaw piece of the corncrake calling throughout the night. But if we get management and we get conditions right for corncrakes, actually we're going to help a whole host of other species.
So we're just weighing the bag and the bird so we can calculate the bird's weight, and we'll have a listen to the heart and get a respiratory rate from the bird as well.
Prior to being released, they are carefully ringed with a unique ID and health checked by vet Mark Nagib.
We make sure that their wings are fine, their legs are fine, there's no problems with their lungs, air sacs or heart, that their feathers and preen gland are in good condition, and that there's no evidence of anything infectious.
And the corncrakes need to be in good shape. In the days ahead, they'll migrate to Africa for the winter, but hopefully they'll be back here next spring.
They've got these sort of silly little sharp wings that you think is not going to take them to Africa, but it does.
Volunteer bird ringer Jean Thorpe has been caring for wildlife in Yorkshire for more than 50 years. But this is the first time she's been close up with a corncrake.
I'd not seen one till we started ringing these. I'd heard them in the valleys, you know, in summer. We used to occasionally hear them, but I'd never actually seen one, so...
The birdhouses on the Yorkshire site are designed so the corncrakes can see the sky. Scientists say this is crucial to the project's success.
They're in there from day 12 to day 38, which is where we are today, and releasing them.
Here's Natural England's Craig Ralston again.
That period is when we think they fix on the night sky or learn the magnetic fields, but that's them fixing Yorkshire and Lower Derwent Valley as home, and hopefully they'll come back within 2 or 3 kilometres of these pre-release pens.
That report from Paul Murphy in North Yorkshire. That's all from us. I'm Anna Hill. The producer is Rebecca Rooney, who can do a passing imitation of a corncrake when asked. Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
As we approach 7 o'clock, time on Radio 4 to hear what the weather has in store for us today. Here's Elizabeth Ritzini.
Hello, thank you, Tina, again. There's a lot of fine and dry weather around this weekend with a ridge of high pressure building in from the south. We're not talking about heatwave conditions, but it will be feeling warmer today, and particularly so across quite a wide area throughout tomorrow. And then low pressure returns into the start of next week, so return to something wetter and windier. But there's a lot of regional variation through this this weekend. For this morning, it's a cooler start to the day, noticeably so towards the south than it was yesterday. Just around the edge of high pressure that's building in from the south towards western areas, we are expecting to see this warm front just bring a lot more cloud and some showery outbreaks of rain. And we're certainly starting off the day with some showers across parts of Caithness and Sutherland towards the north of Scotland. There'll be some more showers appearing towards western counties as well. There will also be some sunny spells for northern and western Scotland, but more cloud building into the afternoon. A few well-scattered showers for Northern Ireland. We're starting off the day with the possibility of a few more showers. And for here, for western Scotland and generally for northwestern England and northern and western Wales, there will be more cloud building too into the afternoon. But here it will stay mostly dry with fresh westerly winds gradually moderating. Across the rest of England and Wales, well, it's looking dry all day. There's plenty of sunshine around away from the far west, where there will be more in the way of cloud. And again, the breeze will ease down as we head throughout the morning into the afternoon. It's feeling a bit warmer than it was yesterday, especially towards the south. Scotland and Northern Ireland, 16 to 19 Celsius. Northern and western England and Wales, 18 to 21 degrees. Southern and eastern England, 21 to 24 Celsius. Now, overnight tonight, it's turning cloudier, windier and wetter with some showery outbreaks of rain towards western coast. Those showers will push further eastwards throughout the day. Tomorrow it's looking warmer still.
Elizabeth, thank you. The Today programme with Anna Foster is next.
Grammar school or secondary modern? For generations of children, the 11 plus exam would determine their future. But in 1976, a law was passed to make all state secondaries comprehensive. Selection was out and the classroom was to be transformed.
The deliberate aim is to create classes that are mixed in ability and social background.
Equal opportunities for every child was the goal. But 50 years on, did reality match the ambition? I'm Lucy Kellaway, journalist turned teacher. I'll be charting the evolution of comprehensive education and exploring the tensions and challenges facing today's schools. Comps, tonight at 8 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4 on FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 5th of September. The headlines today: leaders of Reform UK will try to shift the focus at their annual conference back to policy by pledging to raise the amount that people can earn before paying income tax. We'll hear from the party's Treasury spokesman, Robert Jenrick, and from Jordan Bardella, the president of Marine Le Pen's National Rally Party, who appeared alongside Nigel Farage yesterday.
I hope they will see the next Prime Minister of France and the next Prime Minister of Great Britain.
And should that bring hope or fear, as some will feel?
No, c'est un espoir considérable.
We represent a very great hope for Europe and European nations.
President Trump has said his envoys are travelling to Moscow and Kyiv with a new proposal to end the Ukraine war.
I said, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the two great negotiators, they've done a great job. And we sent them over to see whether or not we can get something done. And there may be a good chance that we'll do it.
General Petraeus will give us his assessment of the war so far and the chances of peace. The Chief Constable of Cleveland Police has appealed for extra funding, saying her small force is grappling with significant levels of crime. And also today, how a statue on a station platform unlocked memories of the Kinder transport.
It was a monument of a little boy sitting on a case, actually, and he looked a little bit glum. And it all flooded back to me because I could feel what he was showing.
Mike Williams is here with the sport.
Good morning, Anna. I'll have reaction from Liverpool's first win of the new Premier League season last night, news of more success for Britain's Amy Hunt at the Diamond League Athletics, and we'll hear why the top seed at the US Open tennis had to briefly stop her match because of the strong smell of cannabis on court.
But before all of that, here's the news with Tina Ritchie.
Reform UK will end their conference in Birmingham today with a pledge to increase the amount of money most people can earn before starting to pay income tax if they form the next government. After yesterday's proceedings were overshadowed by an undercover investigation which prompted the suspension of two party officials, Reform's Treasury spokesman Robert Jenrick will try to put policy back in the spotlight when he addresses the conference at lunchtime. Our political editor Chris Mason reports from Birmingham.
Reform have endured a difficult few days here, buffeted by the undercover filming broadcast by Channel 4 News, which led to the suspension of two key party figures. Robert Jenrick will attempt today to shift the focus back to policy. Currently, most people can earn just over £12,500 per year before having to pay income tax. This is known as the personal allowance. Mr. Jenrick will say later, as Chancellor, he would lift this to £15,000 and estimates this would save most taxpayers around £500 a year and mean 2.9 million people would stop paying income tax altogether. It would be paid for, he will argue, by cutting some benefits, capping foreign aid spending and scrapping net zero programmes. In its manifesto before the general election in 2024, Reform said it wanted to lift the threshold to £20,000. Robert Jenrick will tell conference activists this remains his long-term aim.
The Chancellor, John Healey, is to change Treasury guidelines to help more projects outside London, such as schools or housing, get government approval. In his first major speech since his return to government, Mr. Healey will set out on Monday how he plans to boost regional growth and increase confidence in the UK's economy. Here's our political correspondent, Jack Fenwick.
John Healey faces a tricky economic outlook, with record borrowing costs, an uncertain global situation, and a high-profile pledge from the Prime Minister to deliver growth in every postcode. To achieve that aim, the Chancellor will announce changes to the way the Treasury approves funding for infrastructure. Officials use what's known as a discount rate when approving projects. The lower the discount, the greater the emphasis on longer-term benefits. In a speech on Monday, Mr. Healey will outline plans to lower the rate, a move ministers hope will lead to more projects being approved outside London and the South East. He told the Financial Times that pace was important and said projects around the country would be given a fair hearing.
President Trump has indicated that his two main envoys will take a new proposal aimed at achieving a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine with them on a visit to Moscow. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Steve Witkoff are expected to arrive in the Russian capital today. President Zelensky of Ukraine has said they'll be in Kyiv tomorrow, although this hasn't been confirmed by Washington. More from our World Affairs correspondent, Joe Inwood.
We have an idea for peace. Those were Donald Trump's words as his envoys headed for a weekend of talks in Russia and Ukraine. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, who have represented the US president at a wide range of negotiations with varying degrees of success, are due to meet leaders of both countries to find a way to end more than 4 years of fighting. President Zelensky has suggested a limited ceasefire over the weekend, saying there will be no airstrikes on our part. Moscow has yet to respond. Donald Trump came to power promising to end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. Speaking in the Oval Office last night, he said there might be a good chance that peace could be achieved.
The Chief Constable of Cleveland Police, Victoria Fuller, has told BBC News she's having to deal with levels of crime seen in cities such as Birmingham or Manchester, but with far fewer resources. Two of her officers were killed last month when their armed response vehicle was hit by a car coming towards them on the wrong side of the A66 near Middlesbrough. Five people in the other car also died. Since then, the force has been cracking down on those suspected of links with organised crime in the area. Nick Johnson reports.
PC's Matthew Blades and Tom Clough were killed when their police car collided with another vehicle being driven the wrong way down the A66 in Middlesbrough last month. Paying tribute to her officers, the Chief Constable of Cleveland Police, Victoria Fuller, said they'd paid the ultimate price in the line of duty. Nearly 30 people have since been arrested in the Middlesbrough area as part of a wider police operation against organised crime following the crash. Chief Constable Fuller said Cleveland Police has been staffed like a rural force, despite grappling with significant levels of crime.
We've got the highest crime rate in the country. We've had the largest decrease in officers in the country since 2010.
if you were to look at the multiple indices of deprivation, our police force is number one. So we absolutely need more resources.
Earlier in the week, the Home Secretary said Cleveland Police would be given an extra £2 million to deal with the fallout from the crash, something Cleveland's Labour Police and Crime Commissioner described as insulting and performative.
An independent review into maternity care at NHS hospitals in Sussex will get underway today, led by the senior midwife Donna Ockenden. She'll examine more than 1,000 cases going back to 2018 and meet some of the parents whose babies died or suffered harm while under the care of University Hospital Sussex NHS Trust. Katie Fowler from the campaign group Truth for Our Babies lost her daughter Abigail in 2022 when she was 2 days old.
My life isn't what it was, and it never will be. I will miss my daughter every day for the rest of my life.
We have first-hand experience of how impossible it is to grieve your child if you don't understand what caused them to die. We know there are families who were told that nothing could have been done differently. We don't know how many, and this inquiry will discover that.
The Sussex NHS Trust says it has introduced improvements and will cooperate with Donna Ockenden's inquiry. The father of three young children who were killed by their mother in the US state of Massachusetts has said the prospect of reliving the tragedy through a second trial is extraordinarily painful. Patrick Clancy was speaking after his former wife's murder trial collapsed. Lindsay Clancy has admitted strangling their children, but her lawyers say she was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time. From Massachusetts, here's our North America correspondent, Ione Wells.
After 6 days of deliberations here, the jury announced that with a heavy heart, they were unable to come to a unanimous verdict. They had been deadlocked for days, and at one stage, the jury's spokesperson raised a concern that one juror was not following the instructions, that someone must be found guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Lindsay Clancy's lawyer used this as a reason to appeal to a higher court in Massachusetts in a last-ditch attempt to prolong the trial, but it was denied. Judge William Sullivan said he had no choice but to declare it a mistrial. After it collapsed, the district attorney, Tim Cruz, said the prosecution had not decided yet whether to refile the case and request a fresh trial with a new jury, and said Lindsay Clancy's children must not be forgotten. This case was not about proving whether Lindsay Clancy killed her three children, but whether she could be held criminally responsible for doing so, and where that line between illness and responsibility lies, a question that now still remains unanswered.
Research suggests that nearly a third of Britons believe their poor numeracy skills have made them worse off by an average of £200 over the past year. The survey by the House of Lords Numeracy for Life Committee found that mobile phone contracts and subscription deals were among the things people struggle to understand. Peter Coburn learned maths later in life after being presented with an unexpected tax bill.
Bank statements, all my financial affairs, savings, the interest rates. And of course, now in older life, you've got to think about insurances. What's the best insurance? What about energy bills and so on? The fact that I can now look at, you know, if I'm going shopping, am I getting the best value? It gives me so much more confidence in whatever I'm doing in everyday life.
Peter Coburn speaking there.
Thank you, Tina. It's 10 minutes past seven. And we start this morning in Birmingham, where Reform UK is using the final day of its party conference to launch a flagship tax policy with plans to raise the personal allowance to £15,000 a year if elected. But alongside that, the stepping down of two Reform officials who were covertly filmed encouraging what would have been a law-breaking donation to the party is still very much a topic of conversation at the conference and beyond. Joe Pike, our political correspondent, is in Birmingham this morning. Morning, Joe. Where are we this morning on that investigation which Reform says it's launched in response to this?
Well, they've given us very few details as to who is leading it or the timescale, Anna. Right, that this conference has been difficult for the party. It's been chaotic. It is also, to be fair to Reform, been big too, and the scale of the party's growth is evident from where I'm sitting here inside the vast conference centre. I can see three double-decker buses. One is Reform branded and a huge JCB digger, and they're just really here as toys, I think, really for members to look at. Later, as you say, we'll have major new policy that will affect all but the highest paid workers. Upping the tax-free personal allowance to £15,000 is actually less than the general election policy reform had. That was 20. I've spoken to Robert Jenrick's team, who say that's their longer-term ambition, but £15,000 is what they say they can afford in year one, and all of this is really about fiscal credibility, they argue. Reading from some of the extracts I've been sent from his speech later, the key message seems to be that reform is on the side of workers. We're for grafters, not grifters, he'll say. Givers, not takers. Builders, not breakers. But talking of breaking, the breaking news here in Birmingham has largely been about the undercover footage of reform officials talking about money. And the party's professionalisation effort that I can see all around me clearly has not continued throughout the organisation, and this story is likely to run. Last year's conference, Anna, here, did edge into the surreal. There were sing-alongs on stage. There was a speech from a COVID conspiracy theorist. Reform strategists told me that after all of that, this year's conference would be about showing they are serious. And from some of my conversations, not all in the party are convinced they've entirely landed that message.
We'll speak to Robert Jenrick about that in an hour's time. Also, Joe, away from Birmingham, in Westminster, the Chancellor's starting to make his mark. He's going to announce changes to what the Treasury calls the Green Book.
He is. The Green Book is the guide to assessing the costs, the benefits and also the risks of government projects and programmes. And in the run-up to budgets and spending reviews, that document sort of jumps back into focus. The idea of the shift that John Healey announced in an interview with today's Financial Times is to demonstrate really the value of spending money on stuff like schools and roads, and by reducing what's known as the discount rate from 3.5% to 3%, he argues that will make the longer-term benefits of investing in infrastructure clearer, especially outside London. He told the FT it wouldn't rattle the bond markets because he would stay within the fiscal rules, and that until now the Treasury's Green Book of guidance has worked against much needed investment. I suppose, and it's also a bit of a measure of the pressure he's under and of the economic outlook, that he's focusing on these tweaks, significant though they are, ahead of his budget, which we're expecting in about 7.5 weeks' time.
Thank you, Joe. Joe Pike, our political correspondent at the Reform UK conference in Birmingham. Speaking of economics, we're going to talk about the triple lock before 7.30, but at 14 minutes past 7, we're looking at Russia because President Trump's key foreign aides are, he says, taking a new peace plan to Russia today to try to end the war with Ukraine. It is not the first time that US-backed talks like this have happened, of course, thus far. Vladimir Putin has remained immovable. When Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff have concluded their talks in Moscow, they are also expected to travel to Ukraine for the first time since the war began. Well, James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent, is in Kyiv. James, is there anything to suggest, anything to hint that there is something new and possibly deal-getting in this plan that that President Trump's aides are taking with them?
Well, if there is, we've yet to hear it from anybody. Mr. Trump was very explicit, saying that his two envoys are coming both to Moscow and then here to Kyiv with a proposal to end the war. He said, we have an idea for peace. But when a reporter asked, what are the new proposals, he suggested there weren't any new proposals. I think this is a stock-taking exercise in terms of going to Moscow. I think if the envoys do actually come to Kyiv, and there's still a small question mark about whether or not they actually will come, because there's been a lot of on-off, to-ing and fro-ing on that for various reasons over recent days. I think the Ukrainians will be really happy that they come, simply just to be able to set out their stall, tell them their side of the story, because remember, Mr. Kushner has Mr. Witkoff have yet to visit Kyiv during this conflict. But in terms of the fundamentals, there's very little indication that either side is willing to compromise on the core issues, above all control of the Donbass and eastern Ukraine. And in fact, in recent weeks and months, both sides have been pressing hard what they see are their core military aims, the Ukrainians, their deep strikes into Russia on the oil refineries and other economic infrastructure, the Russians putting huge pressure, particularly in recent weeks, on Kyiv itself. Exploiting Ukraine's vulnerabilities in air defences, simply because at the moment the consensus is that both sides will fight through the winter, and if there's any chance for peace, the most likely time, the most likely optimistic window is possibly next spring. So at the moment expectations are relatively low, but we have yet to hear what the envoys are bringing with them.
Yeah, we've just heard in the last few minutes, James, from Sergei Ryabkov, who's Russia's deputy foreign minister, their first response to this. I'm going to read it to you because it's one of those things that involves a bit of decoding, I think. The key question, he says, is the extent to which the US administration is prepared to invest in finding a real solution to the current crisis, considering the realities on the ground, among other things. It involves not only the root causes we constantly discuss, but also the situation itself, which is constantly changing and not in Kyiv's favour. A lot of words there. I'm not sure they add a great deal to the overall position, do they?
Well, look, the interesting point is his assertion that the Americans can shift the dial here. That is an assertion that is questioned by many analysts, simply because there have been many attempts by the Americans to try and shift both sides' positions. And thus far in this conflict, that it's yet to reach a position where a settlement is in sight, simply because both sides have a very different assessment of what's happening in their situation on the war. If you listen to President Putin, he's given public statements in the last week or so. His assessment of Russian progress on the battlefield and elsewhere is substantially different to the view here in Kyiv and in Western capitals. And that was one of the reasons we suspect that the CIA chief, John Ratcliffe, went to Moscow recently, was not just to warn against any Russian sort of incursion or attack on NATO territory, but also to try and set out to the Russians a more realistic view of just how far this conflict is going. Because at the moment, you know, the Russians are still suffering well over 1,000 casualties a day on the front line. And if you talk to Western diplomats here, they say those numbers are rising and the Russians are really struggling to recruit, to replace. That's just one part of this conflict, because it's not just a conflict on the battlefield. It's an economic one and a diplomatic one as well.
Speaking of which, James, you're back in Kyiv, where you've been many times since the war began. And one thing we do know is that Ukraine is running short, because they've talked about this publicly, running short of missiles with which to intercept Russian weapons. And you see attacks on cities like Kyiv having much more of an effect than they did before. What differences are you noticing this time round?
Well, for the last 10, 11 days or so, Kyiv has been under a sustained attack. Essentially, the pattern before was reasonably regular overnight attacks, quite often combined ballistic missiles and drones. What the pattern has been in the last 10 days or so is a much more sustained attack round the clock, slightly fewer numbers, so more little and often. And particularly what the Russians have been doing is not so much ballistic missiles, because, you know, even though the Ukrainians are short on Patriot interceptor missiles to defend against them, you know, those missiles themselves, the ballistic missiles the Russians are firing in, are costly. What the Russians have been focused on is using more of their fast jet-powered drones. So these are the new generation. They're not driven by old-fashioned combustion engines and propellers. These are jet engines, and they go 2-3 times as fast as the old ones. And the Ukrainians are really struggling to defend against them. The old ones, the Ukrainians could take out about 90% of them. I spoke to a spokesman of the Ukrainian Air Force yesterday, who said at the moment they're just taking out 60%. Of the incoming drones. And those drones are, the jet drones are massively increasing in number. In August, Russia launched about 2,800 of them. There was almost double as many as they'd fired in July. And that's the thing that Ukraine at the moment is struggling to cope with, and particularly the city, because those drones come in fast. There was one very close to us yesterday that was targeted at the security services, which is just down the road. President Zelensky said specifically that the Russians did not just target the building, they target specifically the office where the acting head of that agency actually works.
Mm. James, thank you. As you say, that 30% difference in the numbers getting through, really significant for people living there in Kyiv. It is 21 minutes past seven now. MPs have backed plans to better protect some services for babies, for parents and for pregnant women in England. The move was put forward by a Conservative yesterday in Parliament, who argued that support was vital in the first 1,001 days, that is from conception to the age of two. Alicia McCarthy reports.
It was an unusually well-attended Friday as members from all sides began debate on the new batch of private members' bills, the proposed new laws that are put forward by MPs and not by the government. The Conservative, Sir Desmond Swain, had come top of the ballot, and so the first to be discussed was his infants, parents and carers bill. He admitted this was a novel experience, as this was his first private member's bill in his nearly 30 years in the Commons.
So I'm deeply indebted to the Government Whip's Office, who have been extraordinarily helpful. I don't know what is happening to this Parliament. It's vastly more helpful than I was ever expected to be when I was a Government Whip.
His bill would put a duty on the government to assess the needs of infants, parents and carers, provide information and services, and report back to Parliament every year on the impact of that support. But it wouldn't say what should be available. That would be down to ministers.
What it is doing is making those services accountable and more easily scrutinised by Parliament, and therefore less prone to being deprioritised. And we might recall what happened to much of the Sure Start programme. And let that be a salutary lesson, particularly on this side of the House.
Sure Start was an initiative under the last Labour government to help young children and their families by providing health support, parenting skills and early learning. But the funding wasn't protected and many centres closed after cuts to council budgets under the coalition government. Labour's Sharon Hodgson is a former public health minister and was one of many Labour MPs to back Desmond Swain's bill. She reckoned that too often government reacted to problems rather than trying to prevent them.
Babies should not be an afterthought. There is clearly both a moral but also an economic case for this, and the cost of doing nothing will always outweigh the cost of preventative action.
And there was support too from a Lib Dem, Alex Brewer. She pointed to recent inquiries by the Women and Equalities Committee, which found that women were routinely let down across health services, maternity care and scientific research.
Sadly, I expect this surprises nobody. But the impact is felt by everyone, including men and boys, because it is the mother whose concerns are ignored that can result in her son's health conditions worsening. And the father who has little to no parental leave has less chance to bond with his children, to the detriment of both.
The Health Minister, Dame Diana Johnson, threw her weight behind the bill, arguing that it matched the government's ambition to raise the healthiest generation of children ever.
Parenthood can be joyful, but it can also be exhausting and isolating. Some families face the additional pressure of poverty, insecure housing, poor mental health or limited support networks. And early help cannot remove every challenge, but it can prevent difficulties from escalating and reduce inequalities before they become entrenched.
And MPs went on to back the plan. It will now go off to be considered in more detail.
That's Alicia McCarthy reporting. It's 24 minutes past seven now on Tuesday night here at 8 on Radio 4. It's our next Today debate, and Nick and guests are going to be looking in detail at the triple lock, because how much to pay pensioners has long been a matter of contention.
A rally at the Central Hall, Westminster, of the National Federation of Old Age Pensions Associations draws a crowd of 4,000 old people. Their main resolution is a demand to the government of a 17 and sixpence increase in their pensions. This would bring it from 32 and sixpence a week to £2.10. Unanimously, they pass another resolution protesting at the government's delaying tactics.
That was the 1950s. Fantastic music. In 2010, the Conservative Chancellor, George Osborne, announced his solution to the challenge of protecting pensioners from rising prices.
Now pensioners can say with confidence, they will also be protected by our new triple lock, which will guarantee each and every year a rise in the basic state pension in line with earnings, prices, or a 2.5% increase, whichever is the greater. Yeah. There will be no more 75 pence increases in the basic state pension.
Well, now, 16 years on, with the welfare bill rising, public finances under pressure, there are growing calls for the triple lock to be scrapped, not least from one of the Prime Minister's own advisers, Lord Jim O'Neill, who said that high government borrowing costs would force Labour to, in his words, get real about dealing with the triple lock. Well, to work out the answer, we need to really assess, don't we, the impact that it's had over those last 16 years. So let's do that with Jonathan Cribb, the Deputy Director of the IFS. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's look at the immediate years after the introduction of the triple lock. What change in their personal circumstances did pensioners see?
Pensioners did relatively well through that period after the initial introduction of the triple lock. But that's really because, you know, their comparator is kind of the working age population, and they were really struggling through those early years of the 2010s. The fact is that pensioners have seen slow but significant growth in their incomes over the last 15 years or so, and are probably about 15% on average better off than they were 15 years ago.
That's interesting, because one of the questions that is always raised when you're talking about the triple lock is when you look at the younger generation, new graduates, people trying to buy houses or dealing with student debts, they will say, actually, this focus on pensioners is outdated and you should be focusing on us. Do they have a point?
I think they got some point. 30 years ago, the average pensioner was a poor group. They were 20% poorer than people under state pension age. Now they've got incomes about the same as people under state pension age. And that's not only the triple lock. That's other increases in the state pension. That's increases in work in older ages and increases in private pension. But the £16 billion increase in the state pension bill that's been caused by the triple lock itself, it has something to play there.
Are there ways, Jonathan, in which the triple lock could be modified? It seems strange with a name something like lock. The suggestion is that you can't do anything with it or it all falls. But are there ways to change it, to modernise it perhaps?
Absolutely. The kind of simplest way that would still mean significant rises in the state pension over time would be to do what Australia does. So what Australia does is that in the long run, the state pension rises in line with workers' earnings on average. But if workers' earnings fall for a couple of years because of recession or high inflation, then there's a kind of temporary lock that's put in. Now, there are lots of different names for this, but it's a kind of reasonable way to increase the state pension over the long run that's not as expensive but still generates increases in the state pension for pensioners.
I suppose one consideration as well is that it's almost got its own life politically, hasn't it? So you look at it as a fiscal measure in one way, but then when politicians are talking about it and trying to win votes, it's the kind of thing that sometimes they're frightened to touch because of the impact it might have on their electoral popularity.
It certainly seems that way. I think sometimes people aren't that good at predicting what's controversial and what's not. There's lots of debate about the state pension age and how unpopular it is to put up the state pension age. But right now, the government is putting up the state pension age from 66 to 67 with basically no political controversy or debate. So I think reforms here are possible if they're spelled out in advance and why it's important.
Yeah, that's really useful. Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Cribb, the Deputy Director of the IFS, with a little primer for you ahead of the Today debate with Nick. He'll have a panel of guests to look at this in much more detail, a live studio audience as well, here on Radio 4 on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. It's 7:30 now. It's time for the sport. Mike Williams is here. Morning, Mike.
Hello again, Anna. Shall we start today on what is another busy sporting weekend in Suffolk, where it was a third time lucky for Liverpool in the Premier League.
Here's Alexander Isak. What a start for Liverpool. That was a lethal finish. The Reds looking sharp from the off. Gakpo. Oh, what a ball for Isak. He could be in again. Alexander Isak. That is superb. And Ipswich Town don't know what's hit them.
Yes, at the third time of asking, Liverpool have their first win of the Premier League season. They beat Ipswich Town 2-0 at Portman Road last night thanks to two early Alexander Isak goals. It means the Spaniard Andoni Iraola also has his first win as Liverpool manager.
I'm pleased because we started really strong. I think first half overall, but especially first 15-20 minutes, we were all over them. We put them under pressure and the goals have come of consequence of those situations.
Premier League action continues today. You can hear Nottingham Forest against Tottenham live from 3 o'clock on 5 Live and BBC Sound, followed by Hull City Aston Villa at 5:30. Meanwhile, in Bromley, the new Women's Super League season started last night and the London City Lionesses are off and running with a victory. They beat Manchester United 2-1. Now, as we discussed on yesterday's programme, London City have been the big spenders in the WSL this summer, bringing in several big-name players, the highest profile of those being the two-time Ballon d'Or winner Alexia Putellas. She captained her new side last night, so how did the midfielder find her debut?
Well, I'm still learning. It's the first game, but yeah, I'm agree. It's so physically, but incredible atmosphere. We're so happy. We had a strong beginning, so yeah, really, really, really happy.
And the opening weekend of the new WSL season continues this lunchtime with Chelsea against Aston Villa at Stamford Bridge. That match live on BBC One. Next to the US Open tennis, where Carlos Alcaraz swept aside China's Wu Yibing in straight sets overnight to reach the fourth round in New York. And the defending champion says he's getting better with every match as he continues his return from a long-term injury layoff.
I've been competing this, you know, the whole time. So it's, you know, I surprised myself the way that I'm feeling and the way that I'm recovering after every match. So, because my expectation coming here was about, okay, let's see how it's going to be. So I wasn't sure at all. So I'm happy with everything that is going right now.
Elsewhere at Flushing Meadows in the women's doubles, there was defeat for the superstar sibling partnership of Serena and Venus Williams, aged 44 and 46 respectively. They lost on their Grand Slam return. Meanwhile, the top seed in the women's singles, Arina Sabalenka, had to briefly halt her match against Kamila Rakimova because of a strong smell of cannabis on the court. Smoking cannabis is legal in the state of New York, but not in the grounds of the US Open.
I was like, guys, you can do whatever, you can smoke whatever, you can relax as much as you can, but please do not do it around the tennis courts. It's a bit tricky to handle that smell while you're trying to compete at your best. Also because it was a bit windy, so I don't know if it was like coming from the crowd or it was from the outside because the wind blows it into the stadium. So I don't know, I just hope they're going to be a bit more aware of that stuff.
Sabalenka did go on to reach the fourth round. Coverage of the US Open later is on Five Sports Extra from 5 p.m. Athletics next, and what a second half of the season Britain's Amy Hunt is having. She picked up four gold medals at the European Championships in Birmingham last month, you might remember. And last night clocked a season's best in the 200 metres at the Diamond League final in Brussels. Her time of 22.16 seconds is just 0.08 off her lifetime best and saw her finish the race in third place.
I'm definitely really happy. I think I was, obviously it's nearly 10 p.m. in Northern Europe. It's pretty chilly conditions out here, but I'm really, really proud of that one. Especially, I think that was probably one of the best bends I've ever done, if not the best. And then the long season kind of caught up to me in the last 20 metres, but I'm really, really, really proud of that one.
Hunt will now race in the final of the 100 metres later this evening. In cricket's county championship, relegation-threatened Surrey appear to be hitting form at just the right time. They beat Yorkshire by one wicket yesterday to pull away from the bottom of the table. Surrey have won three of the last four titles. Also wins yesterday for top of the table Somerset and second place Warwickshire and for Middlesex in Division 2. Now, this evening, the curtain comes down on the career of surely the biggest name in female boxing. After 20 years in the ring and a decade as a professional fighter, Katie Taylor will retire after her 27th and final bout. The Irish superstar, who is 40 years old, will aim to become a three-time undisputed world champion against the Frenchwoman Flora Pilly at Croke Park in Dublin.
It's going to be very, very special step down here and the crowd here and the ole, ole, ole is one last time. Just feeling the atmosphere and seeing all the tricolours around the place. I can't wait to hear in Croke Park.
In rugby league, St Helens will miss out on the playoffs for the first time in the Super League era after defeat at Lee last night. Lee have in turn secured their own top six spot. Hull KR booked their playoff place with victory over Huddersfield. Hull FC lost at Toulouse. And just to say, in the next hour of the programme, talking Formula One ahead of the Italian Grand Prix tomorrow, Damon Hill will join us live to look ahead to all the action at Monza.
Good stuff. Thank you, Mike. Simon Jack presents Broadcasting House tomorrow.
Do you still read actual books? Times columnist James Merritt has written one that says we have entered a dark age of learning, losing touch with the written word. We'll be asking for your recommendations on how to get back in the habit. Also on BH, as Sir Keir Starmer says he's standing down as MP, we'll head to his old stomping ground, Holborn and St Pancras, to get the measure of the place. And we'll take in the news, including Reform's conference, with the Labour Mayor of West Yorkshire, Tracy Brabin, GB News' political editor, Christopher Hope, and comedian and writer, Kiri Pritchard-McLean. All this and more on Broadcasting House BH tomorrow morning at 9, or anytime you like on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford. And at 24 minutes to 8, it's time for a summary of the news with Tina Ritchie.
Reform UK will end their conference in Birmingham today with a pledge to increase the amount of money most people can earn before starting to pay income tax. After yesterday's proceedings threatened to be overshadowed by an undercover investigation, which prompted the suspension of two party officials, Reform's Treasury spokesman Robert Jenrick will try to put policy back in the spotlight. He will say that if Reform enters government, the personal allowance would be lifted from £12,500 to £15,000. The Chancellor John Healey is to change Treasury guidelines to help more projects, such as schools or housing, get government approval outside London. In his first major speech since he returned to government, Mr Healey will set out on Monday how he plans to boost regional growth and increase confidence in the UK's economy. President Trump has indicated that diplomatic efforts to end the war between Russia and Ukraine are to resume. It's thought that two envoys, his son-in-law Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, will take a new peace proposal to Moscow today. An independent review into maternity care at NHS hospitals in Sussex will get underway today, led by the senior midwife Donna Ockenden. She'll examine more than 1,000 cases going back to 2018 and meet some of the parents whose babies died or suffered harm while under the care of University Hospitals Sussex NHS Trust. Leaders at the Trust say they've introduced improvements and will cooperate with the inquiry. Prosecutors in the US state of Massachusetts are considering whether to retry Lindsay Clancy, the mother who killed her three children and then tried to kill herself. Last night, the judge declared a mistrial after jurors failed to reach a unanimous verdict on the case. And research suggests that nearly a third of Britons believe their poor numeracy skills have made them worse off by an average of £200 over the past year. The survey was carried out by the House of Lords Numeracy for Life Committee, which wants to improve financial literacy rates across England.
Thank you, Tina. It's 22 minutes to 8 now. An alternative future was on display at the Reform UK conference yesterday. Its leader and would-be Prime Minister Nigel Farage, alongside the president of the French National Rally Party, Jordan Bardella. They are currently leading opinion polls ahead of elections in the country in April next year. The two signed a pact on migrants, which would come into force if they both reach high office. Nick Robinson was there.
Nigel Farage welcomed what he clearly regarded as an honoured guest to this Reform UK conference here in Birmingham. He's Jordan Bardella, the president of France's National Rally, the man who once dreamed of succeeding Emmanuel Macron as president and now, it seems, hopes to be prime minister under a president, Marine Le Pen. Here at this conference, he signed a symbolic memorandum of understanding with the Reform UK leader, the two men pledging that they would both take dramatic measures to curb immigration and agreeing that in future, if Farage was Prime Minister in London and Bardella was Prime Minister in Paris, it would be possible for the Royal Navy to push back those small boats full of migrants and for France to agree to take them back. Now, Mr. Bardella's English is pretty impressive, good enough for him to give a speech for the stage, but not unreasonably, he asked if he could speak in French so that we could capture the full sense, the full nuance of his answers. Jordan Bardella, thank you for joining us on the BBC once again.
Thank you very much.
When we last spoke, you were a candidate to be president of France. Is it now your hope to be prime minister under a President Le Pen?
Je l'espère.
I hope so. I'm putting myself up on a joint ticket in this presidential election, a bit like in the US, with Marine Le Pen as president and myself as chief of government and prime minister. We thought this configuration was the best to lead us to victory, and I'm working with her hand in hand to restore hope and recovery of the nation, which is so much desired by French citizens.
You spoke here at the Reform UK conference. Are you really saying that France, under your leadership, under a President Le Pen, would take back all the migrants that try to cross the channel? 16,000 this year, 200,000 in the last 8 years.
My view on this is based on common sense. If France resolves to protect its frontiers, it means that it will become less attractive for immigrants. And so the problem of immigration from the Calais district to across the Channel to the UK will no longer be one. The unacceptable drama which is unfolding in the Channel and which has made it a cemetery with the complicity of mafioso smugglers who are organizing the traffic of human beings is the fruit of France's own incapacity to control its own migration policy.
You hope your policies, Nigel Farage's policies, if he is Prime Minister, will cut the flow of migrants. But I want to ask you what you do if people still come. Do you order French officers to intercept the boats, to push back the boats, even if they say to you, we are worried some will drown in the Manche, the Channel?
Mais si on en est à déployer...
If we deploy the Royal Navy, as Mr. Farage suggests, that will be a failure for France. It would mean that the measures which we are putting in place could not actually curb the flow of migrants in the Pas-de-Calais district. So we believe it's the responsibility of France, it's a national responsibility, and the policies will have an impact on the number of migrants reaching British coasts. It's not a question of pushback against pushback. We need to respond intelligently to the problem of the concentration of migrants in the Pas-de-Calais district and to stop the smugglers over the channel.
I also want to ask you about your party's promise to have a referendum on Islam. Will you ban the headscarf? Will you ban the veil, the hijab? Will you ban any Islamic religious symbol if you come to power?
With respect, we are not proposing a referendum on Islam. We are proposing a national debate about Islamism.
Islamism, not Islam.
We don't confuse here French Muslims who observe our laws and respect our values and the Muslim Front, which today has taken over radical mosques and who are trying to impose on French society the totality of their views. It must be said that in a number of districts, the veil has become an instrument of fundamentalist activism to challenge the equality of women and the equality between men and women, which is deeply rooted in the very identity of France. Today, the veil in schools is considered an ostentatious symbol of faith, and so it is banned in schools. And we are proposing an extension of that ban to all public service buildings, mayor's offices, municipalities, but also universities.
You're visiting one of Britain's most diverse cities here in Birmingham. Do you believe that Britain, which traditionally has a very different approach to France, risks destroying its own culture?
Yes, well, first of all, I would say that it's not up to me to make a judgment, political judgment, about the UK, because that's up to the British people to decide what they want for their country in the coming years. But it is true that all European capitals and major cities are changing and are seeing their identities and traditions change and being gradually replaced. Sometimes new bands are introduced under the pressure of Islamist fundamentalism and identity politics. And I remember actually an example a couple of months ago of the government of the United Arab Emirates, which is fighting Muslim fundamentalism, who asked their students to limit their presence in the UK, considering that in the UK there was a risk of their coming under the influence of Islamic fundamentalists. What I don't understand is that lots of governments of Europe are weaker in the face of Islamism and identity politics than Muslim countries themselves.
When we last spoke, you told me that the wind of freedom, the wind of national pride, was blowing across all democracies. This weekend, Germans will vote in a crucial state election. The polls say that the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, will win power there. Are they part of your alliance, the alliance between you and Nigel Farage?
As of today, it is no longer the case. In the past, we did work with that political party, but some personalities took up positions in the AfD which were judged to be really too harsh. Now we have to respect, of course, the vote of the electors. But one thing is sure, the surge of popularity for AfD in Germany has certainly pushed the German government to take more notice of the immigration issue, which we are seeing that throughout Europe as it takes back gradually control of its own borders.
You've listened to my questions in English without translation. You're speaking at the conference in English. Perhaps we end with one answer in English, if that's okay. When people see Jordan Bardella and Nigel Farage together on the stage, do you want them to see the future of Europe? Is that what you're saying is coming?
I hope they will see the next Prime Minister of France and the next Prime Minister of Great Britain.
And should that bring hope or fear, as some will feel?
No. We represent a very great hope for Europe and European nations, and we are the way forward for those who have no hope left.
Jordan Bardella, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's 12 minutes to 8 now. In just a few minutes' time, a clinic in Surrey will become the first in Europe where people with no Alzheimer's symptoms will be treated for the illness. We're going to be finding out why. But before that, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra, an imam and educator.
Good morning. This weekend is probably some welcome respite as a good number of children are back at school and routines have begun again. Early mornings, school bags, packed lunches, homework, and the battle to get everyone out of the door. Life is busy. There's a lot to get used to, not least how you find out what they've been up to. Ask, how was your day? And you'll get the usual, fine. What did you do? Nothing. You might get a shrug, a grunt, or the universal thumbs up. Conversation over. Yet behind those brief answers, there is an entire world of thoughts, feelings, and experiences. They've had a day filled with learning, friendships, disagreements, laughter, worries, and bizarre incidents during break time. Asking questions is an important way to maintain connections, to spark conversation. The Prophet Muhammad said, "The only cure for ignorance is to ask questions." But how do you go about it is important. That is the key to connecting with others, whether it's children, families, neighbours or work colleagues. The right question can open up space for a story. That's something that is recommended by a psychologist in a BBC article online. She suggests a more sideways approach, asking something as simple as, "What made you laugh today?" Or, "What's one thing your teacher said that you didn't know before?" Or the most interesting, "Who got told off today?" My twin nephews have just started secondary school, and they really opened up when they told me of their not uncommon case of mistaken identity. One of them was reprimanded by a teacher, who mixed him up with his brother when they were lining up. We know that children often talk most freely when we are doing something alongside them, rather than looking directly at them. The important thing is to listen. Listening tells a child that what they think matters. It shows them that their experiences are worth sharing, and that there's an adult who is genuinely interested in their world. A good conversation doesn't have to be profound. It can be about TikTok, football, or even a playground argument. Keeping the door open may mean that a child who gives a one-word answer today may come to us with something bigger tomorrow. So this year, I'm making a commitment to ask an offbeat question, to wait a little longer for the answer, and resist the temptation to fill every silence. A child may forget many of the questions we ask, but they are unlikely to forget the feeling of being heard.
That was Thought for the Day with Sheikh Ibrahim Moghra, an imam and educator. It is 8:09 now. Finding a treatment for Alzheimer's is one of those challenges that's high up the priority list for scientists and medical researchers. It is the most common form of dementia, which overall around 1 million people in the UK are suffering from. And now a new trial, which is the first in Europe, only the third in the world, is about to start in Surrey to test a new drug which could help manage the symptoms. Crucially, this research will be done on people who haven't yet been diagnosed with the condition. Instead, it will focus on those whose screening has shown to be more at risk of getting it. Well, Professor Ramin Neil Farooshan is chief investigator for the Preventron trial, as it's called, and Professor Tara Spires-Jones is from the UK Dementia Research Institute at the University of Edinburgh. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Professor Neil Farooshan, tell us first of all about this particular trial. It's a drug which has already been identified and you want to know essentially how effective it is. So how will you find that out?
So this drug is still investigational medicine. It's under trial. But the previous trial was for people who had memory problem or at the very early stage of Alzheimer's. Now we're moving one step ahead and we're bringing people that do not have memory problem but potentially at risk of developing Alzheimer's, and we want to try this drug for them, and the duration of trial is 4 to 6 years.
I see. So the idea is this will show you how powerful the drug is in terms of stopping it from actually beginning in the first place.
I mean stopping it could be strong to say, okay, or delaying,
so maybe
it,
more
or preventing
of a slowing it. Okay.
Yes, yeah. Yes, slowing that, or preventing it, because as the name of the trial, this trial has been sponsored by a pharma company called Roche. So the aim is, could we prevent it? Could we delay the start of it? So one of those things, we don't know. We don't know what will happen to the trial.
Okay. And Professor Tara Spires-Jones, what is interesting about this trial is that people have been trying for a long time to identify a cure for something like Alzheimer's, but it's proving tricky.
It is, and that's because the brain is phenomenally complicated. And as a neuroscientist, we don't fully understand how it works in the normal run of things, so it takes a lot to understand how it goes wrong. But the good news is we're getting really close, and the progress over the past few years has been phenomenal. The drug that's being used in Preventron, and by the way, I love Roche's trial names, Preventron, and the same drug is being used in two other trials called Trontier. This drug removes amyloid from the brain. In Alzheimer's, there are two pathologies that clump up abnormally. One is amyloid and one is tau. And what this drug trontinemab that's being used in these trials does is it really effectively removes that amyloid from the brain. And there are two drugs approved already for use in many parts of the world called lecanemab and donanemab that do this in a very similar way to trontinemab. But they're not approved for use on the NHS because they have high risk of brain swelling and brain bleeding. It's rare, but it can happen. And they also don't really have a huge benefit. They slow disease progression by about 30%. So you're still getting worse, but more slowly. And what we want, obviously, is either to make people better or to prevent symptoms altogether, like Professor Neil Farooshan is trying to do.
And as you were describing there, Tara, these things exist in some way already, but they don't provide as much benefit as you would want them to. So what are the chances of this new drug being the one that provides that breakthrough?
Well, we won't know until the trials are finished, but the early data, they've already got trial data from phase two, which is sort of the step before the big trials that really get you approval. And what's pretty remarkable about this new drug is it's got what's called a brain shuttle on it. Again, I just love all of the names of these things. So a brain shuttle, because one of the problems with this kind of immunotherapy, it harnesses the power of the immune system, but it has to get a big antibody into your brain across the blood-brain barrier. And that's a big ask. And one of the reasons that for these dangerous side effects of the earlier drugs is they kind of get stuck in the blood vessels and they don't really get enough of the antibody in. And what this brain shuttle allows is 50 times more drug to get into the brain than if you don't have a brain shuttle. And that allows more effective clearance and hopefully much safer clearance. And the early trial data does indicate that it's both safer and more effective at amyloid lowering. But amyloid lowering might not be enough. There are multiple other things in the pathway that are very exciting, like removing that other pathology, tau, for example.
And Professor Neil Ferrucian, just a final brief thought. You need people to actually join this trial. And as we were saying, it's a particular type of person who might be prone to developing this as time goes on.
That's true. It's not easy to find people that have the amyloid or other unwanted material that, like tau in brain, and the level should be in a range that they could come to the trial. At the same time, we want people who are cognitively intact. So the screen failure would be high, but at the same time, we want to start as early as possible. So I think it would be the same approach that the cancer clinician they did many, many years ago. They started going as early as possible, detect disease as early as possible and try to treat it, not wait until the symptoms fully developed. And maybe that's the reason that the previous drugs didn't fully work.
Yeah, and the way to look at it differently now. Thank you both, Professor Ramin Neil Ferrucian and Professor Tara Spires-Jones. Now let's zero in for a moment on the new series of More or Less.
When I first thought, when I looked at the data, was like, that can't be real.
So unbelievable, I had to check.
The programme that questions our use of numbers is back.
I heard that it takes 20,000 caterpillars to feed one blue-tit chick until it fledges.
We're fact-checking Sir David Attenborough.
Explaining and sometimes debunking the figures and statistics all around us.
Even things with small probabilities happen if you give them the opportunity to happen often enough.
That's an impressive number, but is it too impressive?
The new series of More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting on Wednesday morning at 9.
Let's check the weather now with Elizabeth Rizzini. Morning.
Oh, good morning, Anna. Well, it's going to be feeling a bit warmer this weekend and no heat wave on the way. It will be a fairly brief burst of warmth that's coming in from the near continent on a southwesterly wind. But temperatures will be rising. There'll be some sunny spells. It's looking quite windy and rather showery too in the far north and west. But in a bit more detail then, it's been a cooler start this morning, especially across the south. For northern and western Scotland, some brighter spells, but also quite a bit of cloud and a few scattered showers at times. A few showers too across Northern Ireland, but lots of dry weather here. And it's generally for western areas, so western Scotland, Northern Ireland, northern western Wales and northwest England, where we'll see more cloud, especially into the afternoon. Quite fresh westerly winds gradually easing off a little. We'll be mostly dry, but we could see one or two showers here. For the rest of England and Wales, though, it's staying dry all day. There'll be a lot of sunshine around and it will feel warm in the best in that sunshine. So in the south, 21 to 24 degrees Celsius, further north, 16 to 21 degrees.
Thanks, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 5th of September. The headlines this morning: Reform UK will put the spotlight back on their policies today after a new donations controversy threatened to overshadow the party's conference. We'll speak to Reform's Treasury spokesman Robert Jenrick after the news. President Trump has suggested his envoys will travel to Moscow and Kyiv with a new proposal to end the Ukraine war.
I sent Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the two great negotiators. They've done a great job. And we sent them over to see whether or not we can get something done. And there may be a good chance that we'll do it.
Well, General Petraeus will give us his assessment of the war so far and the chances of peace. An independent inquiry into care at four NHS maternity units in Sussex gets underway today after a long campaign by families whose babies died or suffered harm. Also on the programme this morning, the inside story of the making of one of the greatest albums of all time. Listen to the wind blow.
We were workaholic on that thing. It was just a pleasure. Time of my life.
That's producer Ken Calais reflecting on the making of Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. Mike Williams is here with the sport.
Good morning, Anna. Liverpool have their first win of the new Premier League season after victory over Ipswich last night. Carlos Alcaraz cruises through to the fourth round of the US Open tennis. And coming up, we will speak live to Damon Hill ahead of this weekend's Italian Grand Prix at Monza.
Before that, here's the news with Tina Ritchie.
Reform UK will end their conference in Birmingham today with a pledge to increase the amount of money most people can earn before starting to pay income tax if they form the next government. After yesterday's proceedings threatened to be overshadowed by an undercover investigation which prompted the suspension of two party officials, Reform's Treasury spokesman Robert Jenrick will try to put policy back in the spotlight when he addresses the conference at lunchtime. Our political editor Chris Mason reports from Birmingham.
Reform have endured a difficult few days here, buffeted by the undercover filming broadcast by Channel 4 News, which led to the suspension of two key party figures. Robert Jenrick will attempt today to shift the focus back to policy. Currently, most people can earn just over £12,500 per year before having to pay income tax. This is known as the personal allowance. Mr. Jenrick will say later, as Chancellor, he would lift this to £15,000 and estimates this would save most taxpayers around £500 a year and mean 2.9 million people would stop paying income tax altogether. It would be paid for, he will argue, by cutting some benefits, capping foreign aid spending and scrapping net zero programmes. In its manifesto before the general election in 2024, Reform said it wanted to lift the threshold to £20,000. Robert Jenrick will tell conference activists this remains his long-term aim.
President Trump has indicated that his two main envoys will take a proposal aimed at achieving a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine with them on a visit to Moscow. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Steve Witkoff are expected to arrive in the Russian capital today. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said this morning that the US should take account of realities on the ground, where he said the situation was shifting against Kyiv. President Zelensky of Ukraine has said the envoys will be in Kyiv tomorrow, although this hasn't been confirmed by Washington. More from our World Affairs correspondent Joe Inwood.
We have an idea for peace. Those were Donald Trump's words as his envoys headed for a weekend of talks in Russia and Ukraine. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, who have represented the US president at a wide range of negotiations with varying degrees of success, are due to meet leaders of both countries to find a way to end more than 4 years of fighting. President Zelensky has suggested a limited ceasefire over the weekend, saying there will be no airstrikes on our part. Moscow has yet to respond. Donald Trump came to power promising to end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. Speaking in the Oval Office last night, he said there might be a good chance that peace could be achieved.
The office of Argentina's president, Javier Milei, says it's begun imposing sanctions on 45 companies and individuals it says are involved in oil extraction around the Falkland Islands. The announcement comes a day after Mr. Milei used a televised address to reiterate Argentina's claim to the British Overseas Territory. His office did not identify those facing restrictions, but Argentine media says they include the British firm Rockhopper Exploration and Navitas Petroleum, which is based in Israel. An independent review into maternity care at NHS hospitals in Sussex will get underway today. It's the latest in a series of inquiries led by the senior midwife Donna Ockenden. She'll meet some of the parents whose babies died or suffered harm while under the care of University Hospitals Sussex NHS Trust. Our social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan has the details.
The review is set to examine more than 1,000 maternity and neonatal cases going back to 2018 at the four maternity units run by the Trust in Brighton, Worthing, Chichester and Haywards Heath. The inquiry was commissioned last year after a long campaign by a small group of harm families. Earlier this year, BBC News, working with the New Statesman, revealed that at least 55 babies who died between 2019 and 2023 might have survived with better care. The Sussex Trust says it has introduced improvements and will cooperate with Donna Ockenden's inquiry. This is the sixth maternity inquiry into a specific NHS trust in England in just over a decade. Ministers hope to publish a blueprint for improving maternity services across England in December.
The father of three young children who were killed by their mother in the US state of Massachusetts has said the prospect of reliving the tragedy through a second trial is extraordinarily painful. Patrick Clancy was speaking after his former wife's murder trial collapsed. Lindsay Clancy has admitted strangling their children, but her lawyers say she was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time. From Massachusetts, here's Ione Wells.
After 6 days of deliberations here, the jury announced that with a heavy heart, they were unable to come to a unanimous verdict. They had been deadlocked for days, and at one stage, the jury's spokesperson raised a concern that one juror was not following the instructions, that someone must be found guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Lindsay Clancy's lawyer used this as a reason to appeal to a higher court in Massachusetts in a last-ditch attempt to prolong the trial, but it was denied. Judge William Sullivan said he had no choice but to declare it a mistrial. After it collapsed, the district attorney, Tim Cruise, said the prosecution had not decided yet whether to refile the case and request a fresh trial with a new jury, and said Lindsay Clancy's children must not be forgotten.
I bring it all back to the child victims in this case, Cora, Dawson, and Callan. This was and has always been about getting justice for those three little babies.
Lindsay Clancy's lawyer, Kevin Reddington, said what his client had gone through was not right. This case was not about proving whether Lindsay Clancy killed her three children, but whether she could be held criminally responsible for doing so, and where that line between illness and responsibility lies, a question that now still remains unanswered.
The Chief Constable of Cleveland Police, Victoria Fuller, has told BBC News she's having to deal with levels of crime seen in cities such as Birmingham or Manchester, but with far fewer resources. Two of her officers were killed last month when their armed response vehicle was hit by a car coming towards them on the wrong side of the A66 near Middlesbrough. Five people in the other car also died. Since then, the force has been cracking down on those suspected of links with organised crime in the area. Nick Johnson reports.
Paying tribute to PC's Matthew Blades and Tom Clough, the Chief Constable of Cleveland Police, Victoria Fuller, said they paid the ultimate price in the line of duty. Nearly 30 people have since been arrested in the Middlesbrough area as part of a wider police operation against organised crime following the crash. Chief Constable Fuller said Cleveland Police has been subject to the largest decrease in officers of any force in the country since 2010, despite policing an area with the highest levels of recorded crime in England and Wales. Earlier in the week, the Home Secretary said Cleveland Police would be given an extra £2 million to deal with the fallout from the crash, something Cleveland's Labour Police and Crime Commissioner described as insulting and performative.
Research suggests that nearly a third of Britons blame poor numeracy skills for costing them money over the past year. A survey of 2,000 people was carried out by a House of Lords committee, which is hoping to improve financial literacy rates across England. Dan Whitworth from Radio 4's Moneybox programme reports.
For the 30% of people who said they're worse off, the average amount of money they lost out on last year is estimated to be nearly £200. And that can be caused by any number of problems, such as not understanding mobile phone contracts, being confused by subscription deals, which can sharply increase after introductory offers, or being unable to calculate and try to reduce the impact of rising energy bills. Previous research suggests people who struggle with numeracy earn on average £1,600 a year less than people who don't. And it's something the National Numeracy Charity says can blight lives and livelihoods, creating lifelong barriers to social mobility. The House of Lords Numeracy for Life Committee says it's determined to tackle the problem when it publishes its full report in November.
On Exmoor, love appears to be in the air, or at least in the water. Cameras at the National Trust's Hollingcote Estate in Somerset have captured two recently released beavers grooming each other and spending time close together. Conservationists say the signs are encouraging, and because beavers typically mate for life, the hope is that the pair could eventually establish their own family group.
How lovely. Thank you, Tina. It's 10 minutes past eight now. Reform UK is hoping to move attention from loose pub talk, as leader Nigel Farage described undercover filming of two of his officials discussing a potentially law-breaking donation, back to policy today. On the final day of the party's conference in Birmingham, a plan to increase the personal allowance is the flagship announcement. We'll speak in just a moment to Reform's economic spokesman Robert Jenrick. Before that, our political editor Chris Mason is there, joins us from the conference. Chris, we'll talk about policy in a few moments, but first of all, that story was really at its head while we were on air yesterday morning. What is happening with that undercover filming, the suspension of two Reform members? Where are we at?
It's been a deeply uncomfortable couple of days, I think, for Reform. The arrival of this story coinciding with the start of their conference, distracting from the attention that Reform had hoped would be on their policies. I think, Anna, if we look at Reform over the last 12 months, as opposed to just the last couple of days, there's been three themes: defections, elections, and money. Defections, first of all. This time last year, I was at this conference. Robert Jenrick, who you were about to speak to, wasn't, because he was in a different party. He was a Conservative at the time. Elections, those big wins in the English local elections, Scottish and Welsh devolved parliament elections. And in those two senses, Reform have made big strides. But the money question has been hovering for the last couple of months and has been, if you like, capitalised and put in bold in the last few days.
Thank you, Chris. Stay there. We're going to talk to you again in just a second about the policy details. But let's bring in Reform's economic spokesman, Robert Jenrick. Good morning.
Good morning.
As Chris was saying there, your plan, your hope was that this interview would start talking purely about the policy. But we need to deal with what happened yesterday. We can start with the policy, and we will talk about the policy. But people do want to know what's going on. Specifically, I'm conscious that yesterday your chairman, Lee Anderson, told ITV News that those two individuals have stepped away from the party. They're not coming back, in his words. But then Richard Tice, your deputy leader, said on this programme yesterday, let's wait and see. He said it's not up to any individual to make that determination until the investigation. So what is happening? Because these are senior figures, they should be speaking with one voice on this.
Yeah, look, I'd say this. It was obviously disappointing that they made those remarks that were recorded on this this investigation. It's for that reason that Nigel acted swiftly. He removed them. They have been suspended. There is going to be due process, and that's right. You know, that's what you'd expect from any organization. And so there will be an investigation, and we'll find out the full facts. People will have the right to reply. But I hope you can see from the way in which Nigel responded to this, the seriousness with which he takes this matter. We don't think that Reform itself has broken any rules or laws. We've had a distinguished KC's opinion, which I've read myself, and that seems to be very clear. But was it disappointing that these remarks were made? Yes. Have we taken action quickly? Yes, we have. They've been removed.
Is there an ethos in Reform UK that perhaps trying to bend the rules on money is a good thing?
No, absolutely not.
I wonder, because Nigel Farage he's been a political maverick for years now. And in a way, that has drawn him supporters. But there are some rules that need to be respected, particularly rules on things like donations. Don't you agree?
Of course. And we don't believe that any rules have been broken in this respect. Look, all political parties
have been broken if this donation had gone ahead.
But I don't believe... Well, it didn't go ahead, did it?
But it didn't go ahead because the money was never there, because it was a sting. But if the money had been there, do you think it would have gone ahead? Because all the indications were that it would have done.
I don't know why you would say that. We have a compliance team, just like any political party does. They're actually very impressive people who I know well. And had this donation proceeded, they would have checked out the individuals, whether they had the ability to give lawfully in the United Kingdom. And if they didn't, then the donation would have been rejected. That's the way we operate, and you'd expect so.
Yeah, which I mean, we could talk about this for much longer. I don't want to get bogged down in one point, which is what makes it so strange that some of your staff members will be...
With all due respect, most people really care about who
we can. Well, there's
to
one
the program this morning.
That people care about Reform UK as potentially a party of government. That's what your conference is all about. It's about proving that you are a party that people can trust and they can vote for. On that point, I wanted to ask you about...
Nigel's got rid of the two people who did this. I mean, what more do you want him to do?
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about comments from...
They're gone.
I'm moving on to the next question, which is about... I'm curious about comments made by Zia Yusuf on social media this week, saying the front runner being foisted on the people of Holborn by Labour to replace the former Prime Minister Keir Starmer in our parliament was born in Somalia. This is Sagal Abdul-Wali, who is actually the leader of Camden Council. Why would it be a problem if an MP was born in a different country?
Well, I think the point that Zia was making is, of course, you can stand for Parliament. That's the law of the land if you weren't born in this country. But we do want members of Parliament, surprise, surprise, who are patriotic, who love this country, who are going to put this country first.
And that's the leader of Camden Council.
I don't know this person from Adam, so I can't speak to them. I would say that there are some people who, in the current House of Commons, who do not meet that description. They sit behind me. They're people who represent this city I'm sat in today.
Why do you think it would be an issue that an MP was born in a different country?
Well, the point that I'm making, if I can finish the point, is that there are some people who sit in the House of Commons who don't seem to care about the interests of the British people. They campaign on things like, should a new airport be built in Mirpur in Pakistan rather than comments made about the leader of Camden Council?
And you're answering an entirely different point to the one that I'm asking you.
No, I'm saying that, look, I don't know this person, so I can't comment on her in particular. But the point that Zia, I think, is making, which I would agree with, is we want to make sure that the people who sit in our parliament, if indeed they've been born abroad, are people who are patriotic Brits who put the interests of our own country first. And I think that's fair. And that's what most people would support.
And you
but should we move on and not
Camden...
talk about... You,
well,
with all due respect,
I, the
you spent,
thing is, it's
you
so much easier to move
about,
on. Well, it's you, so much. Well, okay, two things.
It's not
two
about
things.
What's easy. One is, it's one what, is, what people it's, actually care about
no, no.
in the country.
One is it's easier to move on when you have addressed the question.
And you talked about some people who made a mistake and have been removed from the party.
Mr. Jenrick, two things, if I may. Two things, if I may. One thing is that it is much easier to move on if you do address the point that I'm putting to you. The second is there is a bit of a delay on the line, so people might notice that we're talking over each other a little, and that is one of the reasons why, is that there is a delay. Talk to me about your plans today, then, and how you are going to pay for the increased personal allowance.
Well, people feel very hard up right now, and so we've made a big choice that we're going to make savings by cutting the waste that we have right now in the ballooning benefits bill, by not paying foreign aid to other countries, by getting rid of the net zero subsidies. That amounts to £80 billion, and we've detailed that in very substantial documents in recent weeks and months. By doing that, by taking those hard choices, we're able to raise the tax-free personal allowance from £12,570 today to £15,000. And we're going to do it in our first 100 days, the first reform budget after the next general election. That takes 3 million people out of paying income tax altogether. It means pensioners won't be paying income tax on the state pension. It's a tax up for 40 million taxpayers. And it creates a bargain that is at the heart of a reform government. If you can work, you should, and we're going to bear down on those people who are taking the mick. But we're also going to have the backs of working people, particularly people on lower incomes, and do everything we can to make their lives better. Yesterday, Richard Tice said we'd take £250 off energy bills. Today, I'm saying that we're going to be giving people this taxer, which is about £500 for a typical worker, £1,000 for a household with two people in work. That is money that people really need right now, because life is so difficult.
One of the big ways that you'll pay for that is saving, you say, around £50 billion on welfare. And people who are potentially going to vote for you, sitting at home now, listening to this, who will you stop from receiving benefits? Who's getting them now? What people, what areas, what conditions, for example, will you cut?
Yeah, there's three central strands. Number one, We made the decision that as a matter of basic fairness, we'll only pay benefits to British citizens. So those people who are here on other forms of status, you know, who are here just for indefinitely to remain EU citizens, etc., they're not going to get it. I think that's right, because that saves £20 billion every year that we can use to support Brits. Secondly, we're saying that we're going to help people off long-term unemployment benefit back into the workplace. We're going to do this in a number of ways. One is we're going to say that if you've been out of work for over a year, still looking for a job, but you can work, then we're going to put you to work in the local community, maybe doing gardening, litter picking, helping out in the local library, giving you the camaraderie, the discipline, the skills that you need to help you to get back into the workplace with a long-term job. And thirdly, we're going to reassess people for PIP, in particular for mental health, because the number of claimants has effectively doubled for mental health since before the pandemic. And whilst the pandemic certainly left a long shadow in many ways, I don't believe our country is twice as sick as it was before the pandemic. I think we can fix that.
Who won't get benefits then? Particularly, you're talking about mental health there. Is that everybody with mental health conditions? Where will you draw that line?
Well, we've already set out some of those lines, and there are severe mental health conditions. Of course there are, and those individuals will continue to receive them. But mild or moderate conditions, no, they won't. I think that is, generally speaking, medicating normal human experiences, and we need to get those people back into the workplace. It's better for them and their families, and obviously it's better for the economy.
I'm curious about the difference between mild and moderate to severe. It's just because people at home will want to know what category they fall into. That's why I'm pressing you on it.
I understand. And that was the point I was trying to make, that it's not for politicians actually to make these decisions. What we're saying is that you want to have clinicians doing this. At the moment, the system is crazy. You actually can get long-term disability benefits without even having had a face-to-face appointment with a trained clinician. I mean, there are plenty of stings I've seen where people literally gone on ChatGPT, you know, create a letter, had a Zoom call, and within half an hour have managed to sign themselves off. We can't go on like this. The country's going to go bankrupt if we do this, let alone being able to fund better public services or tax cuts for working people. That's the action we're taking. Is this difficult? Yes, it will be. It will be hard. Is it impossible? No, because really what we're asking is, can we get our benefit system back to the point it was before COVID? I believe that can happen. It's not going to happen under Labour. I think we've seen that. Rachel Reeves tried to do this. Labour backbenchers weren't prepared to do it. We'll see if Andy Burnham does it. I'm not
optimistic. Make those numbers work,
but we are prepared
though,
to do it.
The conversation that we're having, particularly about the £50 billion, which is only part of it, and you have very broad brush ideas, but in order to save the amount of money that you need to fund a new policy, those ideas need to be more than broad brush. You should be able to give really clear examples, because that's what those figures are going to be based on, aren't they?
No, on the contrary, I've actually published a 50-page document setting out our welfare reforms. That's more than any other party's done. I mean, the Tory party published a document, I think, at their conference last year, which was 2.5 pages long. So see the contrast there. But I'm not going to be the person who says which condition in particular should or shouldn't be enabling you to get benefits. I don't think that's the right thing. We don't treat people like that in this country. It's not that a politician who isn't a clinician goes around saying, well, this person gets benefits, that person doesn't.
Yeah.
We obviously
the
have to work through that
separately.
The
politicians are the ones who have to make the money choices, though, aren't they?
But that's why I'm prepared to make those difficult decisions. And why are we doing this? Well, one, because I think it's a moral failure for the country that we're parking so many people on benefits. And it's almost 1 million young people, remember, who are not in work at the moment, or even in education or training. But also, as a matter of basic fairness, you know, reform is picking a side here. We're not for Benefit Street, we're for working people, and we're going to put those people first by prioritizing their needs and giving them this big tax cut.
All right, Robert Jenrick, thank you for joining us this morning. Reform UK's economic spokesperson, Chris Mason, our political editor, was listening to that. I think, Chris, that sort of highlights really what Robert Jenrick was saying there, the two sides of this conference. Robert Jenrick really wanting to talk about the policy that he is unveiling today, this big flagship economic policy. But there are other things in the background that inevitably need to be discussed as well.
Yeah, and what you heard then, you're having a robust discussion about it, is a substantial policy proposal. I think it's worth reflecting on the conference at large and where Reform find themselves at the moment. To what extent is this, if you like, the last couple of days and the Channel 4 news stuff, etc., symptomatic of growing pains, a party growing incredibly quickly and how it handles the increased scrutiny that comes with it? Or is it, as you suggested to Mr. Jenrick, and he robustly denied, an ethos question? So when we looked at that Channel 4 news video, there was that implication, wasn't there, of a pattern of activity consciously pursued to breach the law. Now, Nigel Farage yesterday very robustly saying, no, that's not true. That's why there was that bleeping out in the Channel 4 news sting. Tim Shipman points out in the Spectator, and I think there is something in this, that parties and those around a leader tend to reflect the character of that leader. You know, think Rishi Sunak's Downing Street versus Boris Johnson's Downing Street. They were very, very different. They reflected the personalities of the leaders. Now, that's not to say the leaders know what those working for them are doing the whole time for a second. But I guess in the next stage of Reform's attempt to grow and to win a general election, how do they balance, as you put to Mr. Jenrick, the appealing aspects to many of Nigel Farage's character of being, if you like, devil-may-care cavalier, with an infrastructure around him and around the party that can minimise the likelihood of the kind of things we've seen in the last 48 hours? I wonder if that's part of the next scale, the next stage of this party's attempts to do what it's attempting to do, which is an extraordinary thing, which is to go from the size it was a couple of years ago, i.e. tiny, to a party that seeks to govern in 3 years or less than that.
Thank you, Chris. Chris Mason there, our political editor at the Reform UK Party Conference in Birmingham. It's worth saying, by the way, conference season is only just beginning. That's the first of many. We'll be broadcasting from them at the various party conferences on the programme over the next few weeks. And just in the next few minutes here on the programme, President Trump is sending his envoys to Moscow for the first time as well to Kyiv. So we're going to get the assessment on the Ukraine war and the chance for peace from the former CIA Director General Petraeus. But before that, here's Mike with the sports news. Morning again.
Hello, Anna. Well, I know, Anna, that you are going to be talking about Fleetwood Mac's classic album Rumours before the end of the programme. And you probably already know that there is quite a famous sporting link to that album, because side two, track one of Rumours by Fleetwood Mac is the song which features this iconic sporting theme. Any excuse to play this on the radio. Yes, The Chain by Fleetwood Mac was BBC Television's Formula One theme for years. Of course, it's still used on BBC Radio's coverage. Not many pieces of music are synonymous with a specific sport than that. And we are talking Formula One this hour because the Italian Grand Prix takes place at Monza tomorrow. Qualifying takes place later today. And I'm delighted to say that we can look ahead to that race with the 1996 Formula One World Champion Damon Hill, who joins us live on the programme from Italy. Hi, Damon.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing? I can't listen to that piece of music without hearing Murray Walker's voice. I don't think that Fleetwood Mac had intended for him to be in the studio, but for me, his voice is always over the top of that sound. Isn't it amazing?
And his iconic call of you winning that championship in 96 with his famous lump in his throat, of course, bringing back lots of happy memories for many of us. But we're talking about the here and now and the Italian Grand Prix, of course, which, as we say, takes place tomorrow. I guess we have to start with the championship leader, Kimi Antonelli. Could the 20-year-old Italian win on home soil? Well, if he is, he's going to have to do it the hard way, isn't he? Because he's been given a grid penalty.
He has, but he's done it tactically, so it's the right place to do it. Monza is famously short on corners and long on straights, and this means that he's got a chance to recover his position once he's taken his grid penalty, which is a mandatory thing when they exceed the limit of number of power units. Call that an engine, so he's got to take this penalty, but this is the right time and place to do it.
But no Italian winner of the Italian Grand Prix for 60 years. We were just chatting off air and both really surprised at this, weren't we? So, Ludovico Scarafiotti won at Monza in 1966. He actually did the double, winning at Monza in a Ferrari. But they've had to wait a long time, haven't they, their home fans?
Yeah, they keep trying, don't they? And I was surprised to hear that. 1966, that's incredible that they've had such a long run with no winners. And you think about all the Michael Schumachers, and but he was not Italian, obviously. So this is the point, is that Antonelli has got everyone excited, but he's not in the right car. He's in a Mercedes. So you've got poor old George, who's fighting for the championship as well. He could upset a lot of people here if he wins this Grand Prix. But he has to do something to stop the roller coaster of Antonelli, who's had an amazing season, and Lewis Hamilton and Charles Leclerc in the Ferraris, they're in the fight as well. So it's full on down here in for the Italians.
Yeah, that is the point, isn't it? Antonelli might be Italian, but he doesn't drive for the home team, which is of course Ferrari, as you mentioned. Their two drivers, Charles Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton, will have a lot of support, if not pretty much the entirety of the support at Monza. Hamilton yet to win a Grand Prix since he moved to Ferrari a few years ago, hasn't he? Could this be the weekend maybe for Lewis?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's talking it up. I think that it's you know, it is actually on the cards, but the problem is the race pace is very different to the qualifying pace. I think today is all about qualifying. We'll see what happens in the race, because when they get to the sort of tactical part of this business, it's very difficult to predict race winners now this season, because they have these restrictions of the power unit. It's all about deployment of their batteries and so forth, so the tactics in the race can be a bit uncertain. But certainly he could win here. That would be an amazing victory for him.
Certainly would be a memorable one for Lewis Hamilton. Well, enjoy race weekend. I know you'll be there in full today and tomorrow for qualifying later today, and for the race itself tomorrow, which, as we say, gets underway at 2 o'clock. You can hear coverage on BBC Sounds and Five Sports Extra. Our thanks to Damon Hill there joining us live from Italy. And just to say, in the Premier League, two games on Five Live and BBC Sounds later, after Liverpool got their first win of the season last night over Ipswich Town. You can hear today on Five Live from 3 o'clock, Nottingham Forest against Tottenham. That's followed by Hull City against Aston Villa from 5:30.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for that very smooth Fleetwood Mac link as well. I enjoyed that. It was beautifully done. If you want to hear that interview, by the way, with the Grammy-winning producer of Rumours, that album, you can hear that just before 9 on the programme. And then after 9, Adrian Charles is here with Saturday Live. And he joins us now. Hello, Adrian. What have you got on the programme today?
Hello, good morning to you. We have got Alan Cumming on for a start. He is a huge star. I mean, he's presenter of Traitors in the States, which is a huge show. But he's worked in Hollywood in some massive films, on the TV, on stage. He's back to his roots now, working at the Pitlochry Festival Theatre, where he's artistic director. Going to be great to have him on. We got Mel Gedroych, who's also going back to sort of her roots with a new novel, which is set in Leatherhead. It's always a joy to have Mel on. She's got an astonishing range of work under her belt too. And we have the remarkable Eric Ungal Charles. What a story he has. Raised in Cameroon, ended up getting trafficked to the living hell that was Moscow in 1997, somehow lived to tell the tale and came back and found some sanctuary in Wales, where he's a poet and writer. He's got an amazing story. Don't miss that. We've also be hearing again from the gentleman from York, who had a nasty fall at Manchester Airport and came on a couple of months ago looking for the two plainclothes police officers who helped him so kindly at Manchester Airport. We've now tracked those two plainclothes coppers down. Thrillingly, we can't actually identify them. They're just Officer A and Officer B. That's all I'm telling you. We've got the inheritance tracks of Carlos Key.
Sounds good. Thank you, Adrian. Saturday Live then on the way here on Radio 4 from 9 o'clock this morning. Right now, you're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford, and Tina Ritchie has a summary of the news.
Reform UK will end their conference in Birmingham today with a pledge to increase the amount of money most people can earn before starting to pay income tax by around £2,500. The party's trying to put the spotlight back on policy following a new donations controversy. Speaking to this programme, the party's Treasury spokesman Robert Jenrick rejected suggestions that there was an ethos within Reform UK which permitted the bending of rules on money. President Trump has suggested his envoys will travel to Moscow and Kiev with a proposal to end the Ukraine war. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the situation is shifting against Kiev and any peace plan should take account of that. The office of Argentina's president, Javier Milei, says it's begun imposing sanctions on 45 companies and individuals, which it says are involved in oil extraction around the Falkland Islands. Yesterday, Mr. Milei used a televised address to reiterate Argentina's claim to the British Overseas Territory. An independent inquiry into care at four NHS maternity units in Sussex gets underway today. The senior midwife, Donna Ockenden, has been appointed to lead it following a long campaign by families whose babies died or suffered harm.
Thank you, Tina. It's 25 to 9 now. We have an idea for peace, said Donald Trump overnight. Where? Well, he's talking once again about Ukraine. And later, his top foreign envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, will fly into Moscow. Tomorrow, they will, for the first time since the war began, visit Ukraine. But this isn't the first US effort to resolve the conflict. And there's nothing really at this stage, it seems, to suggest that it is a more compelling proposal than those which have been put to Vladimir Putin before now. Remember the Alaska meeting? That was just over a year ago now, August 2025. And that moment, it had momentum behind it. It had a promise of bigger talks to come. But in the end, like other attempts to end the war, it fell short. So what is needed to change things? Well, General David Petraeus joins us, former US Army General, former director of the CIA. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. I'm keen to get your insight on this and various defence topics at the moment. Do you think there is anything new, anything that will compel Vladimir Putin to end the war in this new proposal that's being taken to Moscow today?
Well, let me say first that I'm glad to see this effort go forward. Clearly, there has to be an effort to bring this terrible war to an end. And right now, both sides are really just hitting the others very, very hard on their homelands. The Russian Federation has been devastated with the strikes on their refineries and fuel storage locations and so forth. And then Russia has been going after the port of Odessa, and every single day for over a week now, Kyiv, the citizens have been spending extended periods of time in shelters. But I'm afraid that there is not some new inflection point here that should give us hope that Vladimir Putin would fall off his what are really quite outrageous demands of Ukraine, that they should give up the territory that he's been fighting for now for years, the fortified cities, as it's called, in the southern part of Ukraine known as the Donbass, that they should embrace neutrality, give up hopes of NATO membership, no NATO forces stationed on their soil, restrictions and sizes of their armed forces and so forth. So I fear that the demands are unchanged and therefore, unfortunately, that the results will be unchanged. And this is going to have to continue until Vladimir Putin realizes that he needs a cessation of hostilities as his National Welfare Fund runs out of money, as indeed it's harder and harder to provide refined fuels to the people. The logistics sites that have been devastated, these dual use, think of Amazon warehouses on steroids throughout much of the Russian Federation and so forth. And so I'm afraid that this war is going to continue. Putin, I think, is likely to try to mobilize even more forces through a variety of different means to give this one more shot. But I don't see the prospect that he is going to gain the kind of territory that he's after. And I also don't see yet a prospect that he will feel until probably sometime next year, early perhaps, that he does in fact need a cessation of hostilities as much as does Ukraine.
When he looks beyond his borders, Vladimir Putin, what do you think he will be making of the situation at NATO at the moment? In particular, I'm thinking yesterday President Trump said to GB News that the US wouldn't necessarily step in if Argentina were to invade the Falkland Islands, for example. NATO is looking shakier than it has for years. How do you think he will be considering that when he makes his own plans?
I'm not sure I would share that characterization. Certainly the U.S. bedrock commitment is not as solid, if you will, as it has been always in the past. Although, frankly, U.S. presidents for decades actually have been asking the Europeans to do far more for themselves than had been the case. They are now doing that. You see enormous efforts to beef up the military forces of NATO countries, much greater spending. President Trump deserves credit for this. So does, of course, Vladimir Putin, who has ironically been the greatest gift to NATO since the end of the Cold War. Finland and Sweden have joined NATO. It's never been larger. The European component has never been as vibrant as it is right now. And there's really quite a bit of unity on the support for Ukraine as well. So I'm not sure he looks at NATO countries on his periphery and thinks that, oh, this would be a pushover. In fact, probably the opposite of that at this point in time. Beyond that, he also has more than enough challenges just in Ukraine itself and from what Ukraine is doing in the Russian Federation and also isolating the occupied peninsula of Crimea, where it's very hard to find decent gasoline as a civilian. The lights are basically going to go out this winter, as will the heat. The Ukrainians have devastated the electrical generation capacity there and the transmission. So I think he has enough on his hands by far already. He's still going to try to seize that bit of remaining substantial bit of land in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, the Donbass, and he doesn't need to get into something else. That said, he is clearly carrying out gray zone activities, as they're called, incursions into the airspace of NATO countries, these explosives on drones. So there was a supposed attack nipped in the bud in Poland, an assassination. So there's quite a number of those activities going on in NATO countries to try to discourage them from supporting Ukraine the way they have. But I don't think that's going to produce the opposite effect, actually.
General David Petraeus, really appreciate your insight. Former U.S. Army general and former director of the CIA. It is 18 minutes to 9 now. Just over a week ago on the programme, we heard from Gabriele Keenahan from North Shields. And as she approaches her 100th birthday, she was readying herself to go back for the very first time to the railway platform in Austria, where as a 12-year-old Jewish girl, she boarded a Kinder transport train to escape the Nazis. And even all these decades later, she recalled how terrifying that moment was.
I knew I was going to England, but I didn't know who was going to take care of me. I was frightened. The other thing that frightened me was the fact that the Gestapo were on the platform and patrolling the platform and saying there would have to be no emotional scenes. Now, I just wanted to cuddle my grandmother, you know, but unfortunately I was unable to do so.
Well, now Gabriella has made that journey back to the station. She had her children, her grandchildren with her, and she told me all about it.
When I got to the station has altered so much. It's completely modernized. It's got shops and cafes inside, which it didn't have, of course, in 1938 to 1939. So it was so strange that I initially felt no emotion at all. But then we went in, and there was a monument. It said, "Für das Kind," for the child. And it was a monument of a little boy sitting on a case, actually, and he looked a little bit glum, and it all flooded back to me because I could feel what he was showing, what I would have shown probably at the time when I was 12.
Yeah, because people will walk past that statue every day and they'll see it and they'll see that image and they'll read the words, but none of them will have felt that feeling that you felt.
No, I don't think so, because It's a reminder, obviously, of what happened, of the children who gathered at that station and were sent to various parts of the world. But I don't know how many people would even think about it or even look at it. I just don't know. To me, sitting underneath it, I thought, yes, this was the emotional part for me, because I felt as that little boy looked.
Are you glad you went?
Yes, I'm very glad I went. I think it's put closure underneath the feelings I had, except for that monument. It was very emotional.
The last time we spoke, the way that you described that feeling on the platform that day when you were so young, and particularly the fear, the way you described the fear really stayed with me. And I did wonder whether any of those emotions would come back again as you were standing there.
Well, I did think back of what the platform looked like, because it looked completely different, of course. And it's difficult to describe, but the feeling of my grandmother standing there wasn't quite so sharp. Do you understand?
I do.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine my grandmother standing there, whereas I could imagine my grandmother standing on the old platform. But it was so different. And it was only the monument which actually brought me back down and made me think about what's going on today and what went on at that time.
Yeah. And of course, this time, you were the grandmother standing there. You had your daughter and granddaughter with you as well. It's a family, but of a different kind, different generations.
There were three generations, myself, my daughters and my grandchildren. And of course, we are now four generations, because I also have two great-grandchildren.
There was one other thing, Gabriele, that I thought about as well, because the last time we talked about the fact that for all of these years, you've been telling your story, because it's important that stories like yours continue to be told and people don't forget about them. And you've been doing that all of your life, but now your children, and particularly your grandchildren, because your granddaughter, I think, made a video of this whole experience, didn't she, for TikTok?
Yes, she did.
So now they're telling your story too.
Yes. I think my family are very proud of the way things have gone in my life, because they know that I've had a lovely life. I've had a fulfilling life, and when I think about it, it wasn't meant to be like that, because the Nazis were set on destroying us, and my life proves that they weren't successful, because I've had a full and fulfilling life, yes.
You have. And thank you for telling us about it. And thank you for telling us about your journey back as well, Gabriele Keener. And thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you very much, Anna.
It's an extraordinary story that Gabriele's got, isn't it? It's 13 minutes to nine. Just a bit of breaking news to bring you from the port of Dover. Now, they've said that traffic going in and out of the port is stopped due to an ongoing public order incident. Not a great deal of detail at this stage, but there are videos that are starting to circulate on social media. They show dozens of masked, what appear to be men, dressed in black, blocking the traffic at Dover. So we'll keep an eye on that for you, let you know if we get any more details. For now, let us consider a question that's an important one for all of us, really. Are we underprepared for the next financial disaster? On Monday, the new Chancellor, John Healey, will make his first major speech in the job against a backdrop of surging government borrowing costs, gilt yields causing concern, all reminiscent of the crash in 2008. And the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, also warned this week that challenges, everything from an ageing population to the legacy of COVID, are going to keep putting pressure on the nation's finances. So should we be worried? Well, Ed Conway joins us. Sky's economics and data editor has just written a new book called Trade World, The Ties That Bound Our Past and Could Unravel Our Future. And Gillian Tett is with us as well, Provost of King's College. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Hi, Anna.
Ed, first of all, let's deal with that, because they will hear, no doubt, the words 2008 crash, reminiscent of, and ears will prick up. Does that look like the way we're going at the moment?
Oh, golly. Well, I mean, in some senses, it's kind of, it's not the same, because it's not like the banking system is, you know, in the kind of having the problems it had last time around. But in another respect, you know, it's kind of more scary in a way, because you've got all, I guess, and well done, by the way, to the Today programme for kind of covering such a complex issue, because this is like a very, very, what's going on in the bond markets right now is incredibly difficult to get your head around. But the kind of best way I've got of thinking about it is that we're living through this kind of period where, like, so many of these kind of foundations, the foundation kind of for the modern economy, they're kind of under question. And it's, I guess there's the solvency of countries, there's the credibility of central banks in the face of this inflation that we're seeing kind of following what's happening in Strait of Hormuz, what's going on with the pension market, the extent to which AI is going to be a boost or going to kind of bring the economy down. And then on top of that, you've got this kind of even bigger question, which is, you know, can the network of trading links that around the world, can they actually survive the impediments that we're seeing at the moment that are being put in their way? So, you know, Iran saying they're going to impose tolls on shipping going through the Strait of Hormuz. These are really profound questions. And I think that you put them all together and that helps explain why bond yields, you know, around the world, and this is an international story, bond yields around the world are kind of going up quite sharply. And then that has a bearing on the UK, because it means you have, well, we all know from what happened in 2022, when that kind of thing happens, it can create kind of malfunctions elsewhere in the financial system. And it just so happens this is happening pretty much everywhere. So the US, Japan, the UK, but it affects us because it means, you know, John Healey, he has a budget coming up soon. There's less money available for him to spend. And then there's the deeper question about, you know, reindustrialization that Andy Burnham's talked about.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of layers. I saw your very good piece on the complexities of it all in the week, Ed. And Gillian, to that question, and I am not an economist, so I sort of view this very much through a layman's lens, but when you're coming off the back of a financial crash, countries, governments, they've suddenly got holes they have to fill. And so preparing for the next one seems not a very fiscally tempting or indeed electorally tempting thing to do. So when we look at the way we are now, are we armed properly for a new financial crisis, do you think? Have we fixed the roof and is it waterproof?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that we're very unlikely to see a crisis linked to mortgages again or housing prices, because regulators and financiers have basically taken a lot of measures to avoid that kind of crisis. And that's the good news. The bad news is that there are other sorts of crises like the bond markets you've just heard about from Ed, and or else from cybersecurity and other issues. And those other potential crises are definitely rising. And some of the reforms that were put in place after 2008 have been rolled back. And the government firepower, the amount of money you could throw at actually quelling another crisis, is shrinking rapidly, precisely because debt is rising so fast. And there's another bit of potentially bad news, which is in 2008, one of the key things that got the world out of the risk of a global depression was that America stepped forward and showed real leadership in banging heads together and basically making sure there was a unified response to a crisis. The big question today is that if we have another crisis around bond markets, would America step forward to actually create that unified response? And would other countries trust it enough to actually follow its lead? Because, of course, we're in a much more fragmented world today.
That is a very good question. Ed, we've got about 45 seconds in which to try and answer it. But looking at those global relationships, do you think what Gillian identifies there might be a problem?
I think it is. I think we're at a moment now where, you know, we have all become so dependent on the way that the world economy kind of plugs together. So you're ordering something up from the other side of the world. It goes on these incredibly long journeys to get to you. It depends on freedom of navigation. It depends on all the various things that we take for granted about, you know, the financial system and about the trading system. A lot of that is under question right now. And it's under question for deeper reasons that go back kind of many decades. And it's under question because of, you know, Donald Trump basically kind of poking at the financial system, and Scott Bessent as well doing the same thing. And it is an unnerving time, but it's important to have these conversations.
Yeah, it really is. And we'll keep on having them. And you both will as well in your day jobs. Ed Conway, Sky's economics and data editor, just written that new book, Trade World, The Ties That Bound Our Past and Could Unravel Our Future. And Gillian Tett as well, the provost of King's College. Now, to wrap us up this morning. Something entirely different. How do you turn a band's fiery relationship drama into one of the greatest albums of all time when Ken Kelly is one of only a few people, a handful of people in the world who could actually answer that question, because he did it when he produced Fleetwood Mac's Rumours, which turns 50 next year. Songs like Go Your Own Way, Dreams, Don't Stop, they all made Ken a Grammy Award winner. And his new book about that explosive period, Making Rumours, is out in the UK for the first time next week. And he's been telling me all about that experience.
We had no idea. We were always changing and trying to make it better. And up until the last week, I think the last month we wrote the new song. We wrote The Chain and came up with the ideas for it.
Listen to the wind blow, watch the sun rise.
We were workaholic on that thing. It was just a pleasure. Time of my life. Well, I was just really becoming a really good audio engineer, and I love sound, and they all have these great instruments that they play. And they would let me take all the time I wanted to play with the sound and get an effect on it. It was graduate school for me. There was a time that Lindsay was kind of playing a picking part on his guitar, and that was going to be the bass or the bed of the song. And I decided it would be interesting, be prettier, if I took and put some delays on the guitars. That was the first time I noticed when I did that, he changed his part a little bit to fit better with the effect I had on him. And I went, holy crap, I'm actually changing the music.
Which song was that?
That was Never Going Back Again.
Never going back again.
The relationships between the members of the band, or what it was at the time, the breaking down of those relationships, which must have made for a tricky working environment.
It did. I know Lindsay and Stevie were fighting, and Christine and John were fighting, and Mick would get off the phone with his wife, who was in L.A., and we were up north, And they were all, you know, coming back and depressed. And in a way, they consoled each other. And my job was kind of like, okay, who's feeling up for a guitar part or a vocal now? I had started working with the band on the previous album. We were mixing the previous album, and we mixed Rhiannon, one of Stevie's songs. And while we were working, Rhiannon was climbing the charts and climbing the charts. We were in the studio. Stevie called her manager, and he said, listen, Stevie, if you guys can make another album, like the White Album is doing, you will never have to work again. And I remember she said, I don't want to be a cleaning lady anymore. And she walked into the studio and said, guys, my business manager said if we make a record like before, we'll be superstars. She goes, what say we agree to cut the crap and focus on the music and make a good record?
Which of the songs do you really feel that you can hear that? You can hear that emotion and that tension in the music and the lyrics, and it's really, really bubbling through.
Go Your Own Way, Songbird, Don't Stop. Yeah, Go Your Own Way especially. That was a powerhouse. And you can just hear it in the guitar work and the organ work and the vocals.
You can go your own way. Go your own way. You can call it another lonely, lonely. You can go.
If you were sitting down with that 15, 16, 17-year-old kid and they said, oh, okay, Rumours, and tell me about that, how would you describe that album to somebody who'd never heard of it before?
Now here you go again, you say you want your freedom. Well, who am I to keep?
It's about the lyrics, and it's about the melodies, and it's about the backgrounds, and everything is going on supporting everything else. I don't know if you hear that now. I don't want to sound like an old guy, but I am an old guy, and you don't hear the songs that have the lyrical ideas, I guess. I think Rumors is still on the charts this week. Pretty much says it all.
Not sure how many of us would have managed the personality management that Ken managed.